Okay, I'll go ahead and call to order again this meeting of Tuesday, January 22nd of the Grover Beach City Council, and ask that you all rise for a moment of reflection or a moment of silence for whatever you want to speak to in your heart. Thank you. So now we do, as is always the fun part, we have our first grader tonight to do our flag salute. So I want to introduce Miss Stella Burpee, who is 7 years old, and she attends Fair Grove Elementary School and is in the first grade. Stella has shared some of the things that she likes about school. One of the things she likes about reading is reading, and her favorite book is Stella Luna, which I read that over the weekend, actually, a great book. And science, she enjoyed STEM night at her school. What she loves about living on the Central Coast is the perfect weather, never too cold and never too hot. She also says that she loves the friends she's made and that the people in our community are wonderful to live among. Her hobbies are singing and dancing, and she also loves to ride her bike and always loves learning new things. Her career goal is to enter the medical field. Specifically, she would like to become a pediatrician. Tonight, she's accompanied by her parents, Rob and Sabrina Burpee, and Stella, if you would please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. So, actually, I've got a proclamation for you. And what we're going to do is we're going to turn, have you hold this, and then turn around and face the chief of police. And then we're all going to gather around. Thank you very much. And also have some school supplies for you. And if you would, go ahead and give everybody's a shake of thank you.
Kind of hard to do with you.
And with that, City Clerk, roll call, please.
Councilmember Lance.
Here.
Councilmember Nichols.
Here.
Councilmember Peterson.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Shaw.
Here.
Mayor Lee.
Here. So with that, we'll move into our closed session announcements. And so, City Attorney, if you would recap the closed session announcements from January 7th, 2019, that meeting, please.
Thank you, Mayor. On Monday, January 7th, you met in closed session with conference with legal counsel on anticipated litigation. It was based on existing facts and circumstances. Legislative body of the local agency decided to initiate or is deciding whether to initiate litigation due to the fact that that was not or my office directed to proceed forward with litigation at that time. There was no reportable action.
Very good. Thank you for that, City Attorney. And with that, we'll move into agenda review. So is there any member of the council that would like to change the order of the agenda or have any questions on the items?
None here.
None here.
No.
Great. If not, I'll accept a motion to proceed.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? We will proceed with the agenda as published, and there are copies of the agenda over on the table underneath that TV over there, as well as blue speaker slips. If you do intend to speak on an item tonight, please fill out a speaker slip and give it to either the city manager or the police chief as he's wandering through the room, and we'll make sure that you are called on for that. So with that, we'll move into our ceremonial calendar, where we will do a recognition of Ms. Gayla Chapman, so our former administrative services director, upon her retirement. So I will be happy to read a proclamation and then turn it over to the city manager for some other items. So with that, I'm happy and ecstatic to receive this to read this proclamation of appreciation tonight presented to Gayla Chapman for services to the cities, to the citizens, community, and city of Grover Beach. Whereas Gayla Chapman has served the city of Grover Beach within the Administrative Services Department since August of 1997. And whereas Gayla Chapman first served in the role of Assistant Finance Director, and in April 2001 was promoted to Administrative Services Director. And she served as Administrative Services Director. Gayla oversaw all aspects related to the finances of the city, including budgeting, accounts receivable, accounts payable, general ledger and payroll, utility billing, as well as overseeing the audit process for the city. Whereas Gayla provided exemplary service to the Grover Beach community and the city organization by diligently managing the city's finances during both economic prosperity and downturns to ensure the financial sustainability of our city government. And Gayla showed the highest level of integrity and ethics in her service, which is important for all city employees, and especially for the role of Administrative Services Director and City Treasurer, given the fiduciary responsibilities involved. Whereas Gayla was very committed to the Grover Beach community and demonstrated how city government can respond to community needs and continues to show this commitment as a proud member of the community in her retirement. So whereas Gayla Chapman retired with 21 years of service with the City of Grover Beach on December 28, 2018, and therefore be it resolved that the City Council of the City of Grover Beach hereby acknowledges the outstanding service provided to our community by Gayla Chapman, and on behalf of the citizens of Grover Beach, city staff, elected officials past and present, we extend our sincere appreciation to Ms. Gayla Chapman for her many years of dedicated public service. With that, we'll have Gayla come up, and we will turn it over to our city manager for some additional comments, and then we'll take a photo.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, members of the council, it's my honor to say a few words about Gayla Chapman, our former Administrative Services Director. Just building on the comments in the proclamation, we are honored to celebrate Gayla, recognize her achievements. She has done a tremendous amount of good work for our community for over 20 years. And there are three things that really come to mind I wanted to highlight. One is stewardship. Stewardship of our resources, stewardship of our organization. Gayla exemplified what it meant to be a public servant in working to help serve the community for the betterment of our community. The second is integrity. The integrity and ethics, as mentioned in the proclamation, is important across the board, but particularly given the role that this director is in and the role of financial management, that is paramount. And Gayla demonstrated that each and every day, each and every year, and had the highest integrity for the people's resources and government. And third is commitment. The commitment and love for this community. Gayla lives in this community. She is in this community day in, day out. Every decision she made was with the best interest of the community at heart. She really believed that and practiced that and is an active member of our community, involved in her local school and other community groups. And so she demonstrates that love and commitment even beyond city government. So with those comments, I'd like to again recognize and thank Gayla for her exemplary service to the organization and everything she has done for all of us and for me personally, and wish her well in her next chapter.
I'm in retirement.
Well, thank you for those. Anybody want to say any comments?
I'd love to make a comment. I've lived in Grover Beach for about 20 years, and I can tell you, I have a mother who is an auditor and family members who are accountants. And in that 20 years, you provided security for us that I couldn't ask for more as a citizen, as a council member, mayor, planning commissioner. Thank you, because I always knew that everything was in good hands and there was going to be no messing around. And thank you so much, Gayla, for that. That's a real gift to all of us.
Thank you.
Yes, I'll just feel.
And I just want to add one last thank you as well for your years of service and your dedication to the city. It's obviously shown through everything that you've done personally and professionally as well. And again, your budget acumen has been said to conduct the city's business in accordance with the highest principles of accounting and just personal integrity. So enjoy your retirement. Don't forget about us entirely. Come back and visit every once in a while. But we do wish you all the best of success in retirement.
Thank you.
Great.
I would just like to say Gayla was not only exemplary,
employee, but she also became a friend, and we treasure her, and we always will. Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to say, too, it's been so great working with you. I've learned so much from you with your meticulous accounting, and I could always go to you with a question, and I just really appreciated that. I love working with your family and your kids, and I just want to continue. I'm sure I'm going to see more of you now. Yes. So I'm excited for your retirement, too.
And thank you to Glenn and the girls for coming out and joining us tonight as well. Thank you. So with that, we will move into our public communications. So this is the point in the meeting where any member of the public may address the council for a period not to exceed 3 minutes on any item of interest within the jurisdiction of the council. The council will listen to all communications. However, in compliance with the Brown Act, we cannot act on any items that are not on the agenda this evening. So with that, I do have one speaker slipped. That would be Liz Dukas.
Good evening, Elizabeth Dukas, North Groper Beach. I would like to welcome Council Member Lance and really hope and request that we can get representation of the slightly less than 30% of the citizens that voted for Robert, and that was the next highest vote getter in our last general election, as we sorely need this representation. I had to call the Grover Beach Police Department about a disturbance involving an adjoining neighbor and property issues. I would like to thank and express my appreciation for the officers and sergeant in handling this problem in a professional and businesslike manner. I would like to thank Chief Peters and those involved who have put into place a texting system by which our calls were logged and that we can complete a survey for interactions with the police department and to help create a better system of enforcement. Along those lines, this year marks the 10-year anniversary of trying to get violations of the building code enforced with the same adjoining neighbor. 10 years ago, we didn't have the hashtag MeToo movement, but today we do. Today we have an abundant and painful recognition of those in power who may do wrong. I have been bullied and shamed and told horrific lies about. We should not stand for that any longer. I am tired of being bullied because homeowners want to cover up their illegal uses and illegal building activities. I am in receipt of a letter by City Attorney Hill from November 2018 that has outlined all the reasons why this house is not in violation of any California building codes or local ordinances and the zoning laws. I will have to respectfully disagree with many of Mr. Hale's points as they are not based in fact nor hold up under the California building codes, local ordinance, and zoning laws. Because of the illegal configuration of this house, I have endured since February of 2009, mind you, drug use, drug deals, alcoholism, verbal sexual assault, being called horrible names and threatened during alcoholic and drug rages, sometimes in the middle of the night, repeated fights and arguments between the upstairs and downstairs tenants, children asking their mother if they can have oatmeal, they are hungry, court cases, default judgments, requests for restraining orders, counsel appearances, on and on. As a matter of fact, just a little over a month ago, one of the female tenants of the upstairs unit locked the other female tenant out of the upstairs unit while filming her behavior. There was crying and crying, pleas for help. Please, this person was injured and her back and neck hurt from some procedure. Then finally, the locked out tenant asked the other, standing on the small platform of the only door to the upstairs unit, if she could at least have her car keys so she can go sit in her car. and it's happened twice again since then, with the homeowners fighting between the other, all occurring on this second-story back staircase, which was originally only a secondary exit from the second floor of a single-family home overlooking and within feet of my backyard and home. I will again submit my reply to his letter, file more complaints, and continue on this uncalled-for journey to compliance with our laws. At the very least, per the state architect's office, this back staircase needs to be enclosed for the health, safety, and welfare of the occupants and, in my case, resolve this long-standing nuisance. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. And is there any other member of the public that wants to speak at this time? Seeing no one come forward, I will go ahead and close public communications, and we will move into our consent calendar. So where we have a number of routine items, we've got, as listed on the agenda, looks like we've got one, two, three, four, five, six. We have six routine items this evening. Are there any members of the council that would like to pull any items or have any questions? Okay, I did have just one item, which I've already shared with the city manager with regards to the minutes of January 7th. That is just a quick correction of the motion maker to Mayor Pro Tem Shaw. So with that, I'll open this item up to the public, see if there's anyone who wants to speak on any item on the consent agenda. Seeing no one come forward, I'll go ahead and accept a motion.
I'll move that we accept the consent agenda items.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any other discussion?
We're not understanding what you're saying.
This is for the consent calendar. Yes, per the agenda, we have, again, six items that are on the consent calendar, routine items, which we have now a motion and a second. So it looks like we can do this. We need a roll call vote, please.
Mayor Pro Tem Shaw.
Yes.
Councilmember Nichols.
Yes.
Councilmember Lance.
Yes.
Councilmember Peterson.
Yes.
Mayor Lee.
Yes. Motion carries. Thank you. That'll move us into our public hearing of item number 8, so which is an introduction and the first reading of a proposed ordinance to amend regulations incorporating the definitions of tobacco paraphernalia. So I'm seeing the city police chief come forward, so I'll turn it over to him.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Mayor, members of the council, tonight staff brings before you an amendment to Grover Beach Municipal Code ordinances regarding tobacco regulations. In September of 2016, the City Council adopted Ordinance Number 16-03, which was updating three ordinances in the City of Grover Beach to consistent with state law regarding tobacco regulations. A recent review by staff determined that two of those ordinances did not have the definition for tobacco paraphernalia included in them. So tonight's item is to add that definition of tobacco paraphernalia to the two ordinances that are attached to your staff report. So right now the staff is asking that you consider the testimony and introduce the item and schedule for the first reading and of the ordinance as well as the second reading and adoption at a subsequent meeting.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the chief?
I have none.
Okay.
I have none.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you. So with that, I will open the public hearing and consider public testimony. I don't have any speaker slips on this item, but if there's anyone that wishes to come forward and speak on this ordinance, please do so now. Seeing no one come forward, I'll go ahead and close the public hearing and bring it back to the council for discussion, motion, and direction.
I don't have anything by way of questions or clarifications of anything. I think it's interesting that the word paraphernalia is finally being included in the ordinance. And if no one else has any questions or comments, I am prepared to make a motion.
Looks like the floor is yours.
Okay. I move that the ordinance regarding tobacco regulations by title only and call for a second hearing at the next regularly scheduled meeting.
I'll second.
So we have a motion and a second. And just to confirm, that's to introduce and conduct the first reading of the ordinance by title only, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And any other discussion? Roll call, please.
Councilmember Nichols.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Shaw.
Yes.
Councilmember Lance.
Yes.
Councilmember Peterson.
Yes.
Mayor Lee.
Yes. Okay. We will see this at the next meeting, I'm sure. So thank you for that. Thank you, Chief. So with that, I'm going to talk slowly as our Public Works representatives settle into their seats and bring up their PowerPoint presentation for Newport Avenue Rehabilitation Project Final Design. So, City Manager, did you want to do any introductory comments first?
Sure, I can do that. What's before the Council tonight is a request from staff and a recommendation to approve the final design for the Newport Avenue Improvement Project. This is really the culmination of two council discussions over the past year, four public meetings in 2016, 2017 to get public input, really coming into this project, which is shaping up to be the largest single street project in the Measure K-14 street repair program. So this is a very significant project, and we wanted to make sure we were sharing the final design with the council and walking through section by section. Ultimately, we are asking for the council's policy approval before going forward into construction bidding and beginning the next phase of the project. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Ray and Ms. Wiggin.
Thank you, City Manager Bronson, and good evening, Honorable Mayor and City Council, and new Council Member Lance. So moving into that, thank you for the introduction. A couple of kind of background items on Measure K-14 first. This is the fifth year of our Measure K-14 project. And, you know, it's a $48 million project funded by property taxes. To date, projects 1 through 5 and 7 are complete. 6 is the subject of this item tonight. So to date, over 150 city blocks have been improved. And that represents roughly 40% of all local streets. Moving on to Newport Avenue, part of Measure K-14 has taken a little longer to get to the completion of design, primarily because of the complexity of this. It's 14 blocks of rather intensive interactions with a lot of private properties and a fairly complex street grades. The city did host a series of public meetings for residents on Newport and nearby streets, and based on that input, from several public meetings and guides from council, staff identified a range of design options for council's consideration. Those were presented to council on May 21st last year, and then conceptual plans were presented to council again on August 20th of last year. Council selected a street narrowing strategy that includes buffered bike lanes, bulb outs at intersections, and chicanes where possible. And so when we went into the design, and I'll mention that Anna Cow with Canon Design Consultants is here this evening. And in case we get into detailed design questions, she'll be here to assist us. But I'll have to give Canon some credit. They did a great job on this design. And we gave them kind of the following criteria when we went into that, and that was to control costs to the extent possible, to minimize conflicts with existing conditions. Drainage was one of the critical ones. To improve bike and pedestrian safety, to reduce maintained pavement, to provide traffic calming, to the extent possible to maintain consistency in the street width and improvements, to maintain a residential street appeal, and then finally and most importantly, to comply with state standards for striping and for the improvements, bike and ped improvements that we are proposing. So the final design features, which you do have a copy of the full site layout in your staff report, but the final design features include buffered bike lanes, which are there to improve bicycle safety, also provide traffic calming. There's bulb outs at every intersection, and that improves pedestrian safety, and it's also a traffic calming item. Proposing decomposed granite pathways to infill between existing concrete sidewalks. And that is, of course, to improve pedestrian safety, and it does maintain that residential street appeal. And also, we do have the minimum striping necessary to meet state standards. And that striping is there to improve pedestrian and bike safety, but we've minimized it to the extent possible to keep that residential street appeal. There is a chicane between North 13th and North 14th Streets, and you'll see it's rather minor, but it does exist. And that is there for traffic calming. It does minimize conflicts with some existing improvements, and we also were able to use that to maintain a consistent street width in that 13th to 14th area of the city. There are detached parkway planner areas throughout, and that is those were designed to reduce maintained pavement, again, to maintain consistency in street width, and in some cases to minimize conflicts with existing improvements, including drainage. And then travel lanes throughout are predominantly 11 feet, so, you know, narrower than a kind of the wide standard 12-foot lanes, and that is reduces maintained pavement and does provide additional traffic calming. So there's essentially four segments or four different design components throughout this project, and we'll just kind of walk you through each of them so you have a general idea, and then when I'm finished with this, I'll be able to answer questions about those. But from North 4th to 5th Street, it remains relatively unchanged. It'll be getting repaved. It does include full 32-foot travel and parking lanes, which is somewhat excessive, but we'll explain why. There are sharrows for bicyclists instead of a full bike lane striped. The parking is typical parking adjacent to the curb. We did do infill decomposed granite walkways. They're 6 feet wide. There are bulb outs at the corner of 5th, but not at 4th. And so the bulb outs and the bike lanes were eliminated there at the intersection of 4th and Newport because primarily of the grades, the significant slope of 4th Street there, and how Newport sort of dives into 4th Street. We would have had to have done significant improvements to 4th Street itself, and will have to ultimately to get the bulb outs and get the drainage to work and to make us improve the crossing there on 4th Street at Newport. So we determined in the meantime that it wouldn't be cost-effective to do a lot of work on the street, only to have to just go right back in and tear it out. And that would include the bike lanes. If we align the bike lanes where you'd typically put them with this existing configuration, we'd just be grinding those off of the brand new pavement and restriping them in their future location at some point. So that kind of explains 4th to 5th, excuse me. So moving on then, and there's you have this in your report, but this is the overhead shows kind of that 4th to 5th improvement area. So it is unique and stands alone in this project. Then between North 5th and North 12th Street, you see a different segment, and that it includes 11-foot travel lanes, so it is narrowed. 9-foot parking areas are adjacent to the travel lanes, so you have travel lane parking. You have a 4-foot bike lane buffer, and that is outside of the parking. And then there's a 5 to 8 foot bike lane, which is now adjacent to the curb. So this is your buffered bike lane. We did also do 6 foot wide infill walkways of decomposed granite. And then there are bulb outs at all the intersections in this segment. Curb ramps are designed and shown for installation where required by law. There are not many locations in this project where they're not required, but only at locations where a sidewalk leads up to them. And those bulb outs will have decorative rock in them in areas that don't need to be concrete. And so, pardon me? Oh, yeah, if necessary. I can zoom into these if you're having problems seeing. So if we come back or if you have any questions while I'm doing this. But this is representative of that section between 5th and 12th. And you can see, in fact, I will zoom in just so you can see. There we go, if that helps you see it a little better. So you can see on this, I can get the mouse. That's the buffered area. It gets striped out. You'll see these curb segments that protect the bicyclists from the parked vehicles. The vehicles will be parked here. And here's your buffered bike lane. And the driveways project through to the individual houses. So in the next unique segment is from North 12th to North 16th. And it is similar. It has 11-foot travel lanes again, but it has a traditional 5-foot wide Class 2 bike lane. That's where the bike lane is immediately adjacent to the travel lane. The 8-foot parking areas are next to the curb in this case, so more like a typical street layout. There are detached landscape parkways. They range between 5 and 15 feet wide. We did, again, the decomposed granite infill walkways, bulb outs at all the corners, and accessible ramps. And I will zoom in so you get a better look at that. That shows you kind of a representative segment that, with the detached planter areas and the standard bike lane. This also happens to show the chicane. It's pretty minor, but it is a kind of a departure from the standard alignment. So, and this was done primarily to, first of all, to provide traffic calming, but it also addresses some rather significant unimproved areas that would be really costly to try to widen and improve. So, again, trying to save cost on the project. And then the final section is North 16th to Oak Park Boulevard. And again, you have 11-foot travel lanes, same Class 2 bike lanes, traditional, 8-foot parking areas adjacent to the curbs, detached landscape parkways again, bulb outs at the intersections, and accessible ramps. And I'll jump right to that. Good. And there we go. And I'll just zoom into a section of it so you can kind of see here. These are your detached planter areas, typical Class 2 bike lane, 11-foot travel lanes. Now, parking is here adjacent to these planter areas. And then your driveways project through. So those are the segments that are kind of unique. It did require 4 different segments really to address all the interactions with private properties, driveway slopes, and the street configuration itself. So, I gotta find, there it is. And so that concludes my presentation. What we're seeking tonight is for council's endorsement of this design, and so we can move on to bidding and construction.
Very good. Thank you for that presentation. Is there any questions to my left?
I have questions. Okay. As I've stated before, I'm a resident of Newport, but the city attorney said I don't have to recuse myself since we're all going to be in this situation at some time or another, hopefully, with our street getting fixed. But I do have quite a few questions because I do look at the street a lot. The planters that are in the design, because the one consistent thing I heard at all the meetings was we don't want a median. So I just want to be sure these planters are nothing like a median, right?
That's correct. So as you heard and as we heard consistently throughout, the residents did not want to see a median which is down the middle of the road. And the primary reasons were that it blocked access to their driveways. If you're in the opposing direction, you'd have to go kind of around the block, or you'd have to have some kind of a median that you could drive over. They didn't like the potential that it could be planted and perhaps block views. So, no, these are nothing like medians. They're, okay. They're parkways.
And then what will be in the planters?
So initially, they will be filled with decomposed granite. We are extending empty conduits to each of them so that if a person wanted to extend irrigation out there, they could simply use that conduit to extend irrigation from the private irrigation system to those, and they could be planted. The goal is to have a sort of a planting palette available that identifies drought-tolerant, easily maintained plants that would be also provide sort of a uniform look. And so those thought process was perhaps we could engage with private residences and approve planting of those in the future. But for now, just decomposed granite.
Okay.
Similar to what you see on Long Branch.
Okay. Maybe there'll be opportunity for outreach then once they're built. Let's see. So I'm understanding instead of having sidewalk infill, everywhere there's not a sidewalk, there will be a decomposed granite path.
That is correct.
So someone could feasibly walk their dog then the entire way on Newport.
Absolutely, end to end.
And then just so people know, like, how much cost savings is there by not doing the sidewalk infill versus the decomposed granite, just like a ballpark?
You know, off the top of my head, I haven't really thought of it. I mean, it's in a project of this size, it's going to be in the hundreds of thousands.
Okay. All right. And then I just want to go back to the area between 4th and 5th. I'm very familiar with that grade when you're turning from 4th Street, you know, onto Newport. It's terrible. And I'm just worried this is one of those circular things where, well, we're not going to fix this because in the future we're going to fix 4th Street. But by the time we ever get to 4th Street, then, oh, well, now we've run out of money for Newport and this terrible grade doesn't get fixed. I mean, really, I guess my question is, how long is this Newport repair meant to last? Shouldn't we at least just, you know, fix and put in the bike lane now? Or do you feel very confident we're going to get to 4th Street in the very near future and be able to fix that grade?
So a couple things. First of all, we are going out with advertising a request for proposals for design of North 4th Street and others, Grand okay. Avenue and South Oak Park included. That doesn't assure us that we'll have the funding or that council will select North 4th as the next project, but certainly it will be designed in the near future and ready to go. I can also say that Measure K funds cannot be used to improve 4th Street.
Right.
So you currently don't have the funding to do these improvements.
Right.
So I really can't do them anyway.
Well, that's what worries me about the idea of let's leave Newport until we can get to 4th Street, because I don't know exactly, because we don't have the funds for 4th Street. And I know you can't fix the whole grade because you can't touch 4th, but I guess I'm a little conflicted. I just don't like the thing of let's leave it and get to it later, because we may not have the funding. And it just seems odd to me that those residents would not have a bike lane because of a future endeavor that may or may not happen. I guess that's...
And perhaps that's a part of a larger discussion that we have on streets. I think there was an item, either was it on tonight's, with regards to improvements of design improvements for 4th Oak Park and South Grand. Or South Oak Park and Grand.
So I guess my question then is, if we do it this way and we do get the money, let's say we as a council decide 4th Street's the next priority, let's say the Newport, this construction is complete, will we still be able to go back and really fix that grade, or will we say, oh no, now Newport's done, we really can't fix that grade?
I think it's kind of the opposite. If that makes sense, if we, as it stands right now, we're putting sort of the minimal into this. That is just basically paving it and doing some decomposed granite infill. So that would be the minimum improvements that we would need to remove.
Okay.
If we were to expend a lot of Measure K14 money on this segment, then there'd be a significant amount of improvements to remove. And that might in itself be an impediment to wanting to do that. So
okay.
As we're trying to give it the best success of having 4th Street done and having changes to this intersection for pedestrians as well as the vehicle path. And that was at least staff's opinion, was that having the minimum cost of reconfiguration would provide the most support for that getting done.
Okay. I just want to be sure we're not giving up on the opportunity to fix that grade, because it is bad. The one thing that did come up in one of the community meetings, and it wasn't necessarily part of the staff report, but I was wondering if I was remembering this part correctly, that Newport is listed somewhere as a possible future circulator street. I'm not sure if I'm remembering that correctly.
In the city's circulation element of the general plan, Newport is a collector. So it is a collector.
A collector, okay. Because I know that we were debating at different times, well, the many reasons for narrowing the street, including traffic calming, but in my mind as a resident, one of the reasons for narrowing is so that it never becomes that major, major collector, because I don't want to live on 4th Street. I want to live on Newport. Do you agree that by doing these narrowing modifications, we will probably cut down on that future traffic if and when it ever comes?
I think certainly these improvements will have an impact on the speed of traffic. I think a fairly nice pavement and with new striping has the potential to encourage new motors. I mean, it is a collector street. Whether or not these improvements impact that or not, I'm not sure. I can assure you that because the general plan is our guiding document, we're designing this as if it continues to be a collector.
Okay.
So there's nothing about this that prohibits it from operating as a collector.
Okay.
But the all the bulb outs, the chicane, the narrowing of the lanes, everything that you see in these proposed design drawings would support traffic calming, which is what you would want. If you have to live on a collector, you want the collector to operate as safely as possible.
And yes.
This is kind of the end result.
All right. All right, thank you. That's all my questions.
Okay. I need some clarification here. In the design, are you saying that the grade of the Newport going down to meet 4th Street is going to be leveled out or something?
There's still going to be a grade heading westbound on Newport to 4th Street, but it's primarily the difference in grade between 4th Street and Newport that needs to be resolved in the corner ramps, and the drainage is going to be a bit of a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So I would anticipate quite a bit of work at that intersection to try to establish bulb outs, to possibly even bulb out into 4th Street to reduce the crossing width at Newport on 4th Street, to improve the crosswalks. So there's a whole host of improvements that need to happen there.
All right.
And they're relatively significant related to the grades.
Okay. Thank you.
Just came to my attention, I'm just for clarification purposes, where it says like address 474 right there where the bulb out is, and there appears to be a driveway. I didn't see that in any other parts. Is that what's in between the bulb out and that driveway right there? Or is that not a driveway?
That's a walkway, I think you're seeing. Let me see if I'm...
You just want to put the cursor... Yeah.
Here?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, that's just a walkway.
Got it. Thank you.
I had one question.
Sure.
Mayor Pro Tem Shaw prompted this one. One of the things that I've heard over the years, and certainly what makes it such a spectacular boulevard, is the ocean views. And I'm a little bit concerned about the planters, that we're not putting anything, it sounds as if we're not putting anything into effect there, that if someone wanted to, they could plant very big, tall trees in there. Is there going to be any limitation to what could be planted there?
So what staff is proposing is that we come up with a plant palette and guidelines, and then we could come back to council, and if council wanted to establish that as a policy for allowing planting in this area, we could move forward with that and have that, you know, private public interaction for planting and maintaining those. But we would anticipate a plant palette that would include drought tolerant and rather low lying plants. So the view would not be obstructed.
Okay. So we'll come back to that as part of probably comments after public comments. But I did have one question, or perhaps two. If you can go to the area between 9th and 11th for just a moment. I'm sorry, between it's attachment 3, which is has 12th and 13th Street visible on the top component.
13. Okay, we'll have to go all the way down. Yeah, it's not one of the it's exhibits. It's in your report.
Oh,
just
okay.
A moment. Okay, we're talking about here, so. 12th
okay. Yes, it's
13th.
the top component there.
Yes.
Okay, and my question becomes just for those that live on the street, on the top you'll see in that section there it's travel lane, bike lane, parking, correct? In the section between 12th and 13th, and then there's a transition to where the bicyclists are going to go towards the curb, correct? And then the parking is adjacent to the drive lane. Is there going to be striping, or is there obviously there's going to be curbs and so forth that people are going to be able to park against? So is there what other demarcations will the parking public have that this is an acceptable spot to park?
So let's look at a couple things here. Here is west of 12th Street, between 11th and 12th, and you see the bike lane buffered area. It's a striped area, and it's tough to see, but that's a curb. And so these are stripes. These hard black lines you see, those are stripes that indicate that's a buffered area, not to be parked in with the diagonals across it. These curbs are where you would park up adjacent to, as opposed to this block, where it's typical configuration where parking is here and the bike lane is here, and it's not a protected bike lane other than it's striped.
So there's no striping to indicate where the parking is currently?
There is no parking demarcation in particular, and that was in an effort. We had considered it in the design process. We were trying to eliminate as much striping as possible. The street starts to look very much like a collector or a commercial street, the more parking. So that was our thought process anyway, was to eliminate those. But those could be, reconsidered.
Very good. Then I just had one other question, which is going to be between 14th and 16th.
So that's essentially that second. That
right.
Bottom block there, yeah.
Okay. And I just really want to confirm that with the slopes coming to the south of Newport, that the low planters filled with DG, decomposed granite initially, that is to help with the slopes transition between the existing sidewalk and the travel lanes, correct?
It is somewhat, yeah. This segment's pretty challenging. From a design perspective, you'll see kind of some unusual things happening. Let's see if I can get the mouse over there. I mean, here, this drainage path through here and the detached part or the detached planters, they're there to narrow the street primarily, but they had to be detached because we had to run the drainage essentially along the existing curb. It doesn't, because of the way the driveways are configured, if we try to bring the drainage out further, we start running into significant grade issues. So they perform sort of multiple function there. They narrow the street. They reduce the maintained paved width, clearly. They help us make up that grade by sort of forcing the street improvements to the north, and that helps us address that grade to the south, and it allows us to continue with the drainage path. So.
Okay. Thank you. So not seeing any other questions up here, I will go ahead and open this to the public and see if anyone wants to speak on this item. I have one speaker slip, and that's Rex and Jerry Lanier.
Thank Thank you, City Council, for the opportunity to speak tonight. I would have handed out something that was printed, but my printer broke, so I have to read it out to you. Bear with me. We're homeowners on Newport Avenue and have tried to be proactive with the decisions concerning our streets in the city. We've seen a variety of street repairs and repaving after the bond was passed and issued. We do not agree with the council's decisions in regards to some of the street repaving, nor do we agree with the current designs for Newport Avenue, especially these designs. When the city approached the citizens for the bond issue, we in good faith voted for this bond for street repaving. What we expected to happen was repaving of the streets in full, aligning the sidewalks with other sidewalks. This has not been the case. A lot of money has been spent on the design and restructuring of the streets. This is the case with Newport. I'm sure it is not without challenges, but according to the two meetings scheduled to discuss this street, the city council meetings expressing our concern that Newport would not be repaved as is, we are sure that the city council is not representing our best interests and concerns on repaving Newport Avenue as a whole. Once again, we express our opinion that the best speed deterrent are drainage culverts at the intersection, not bulb outs that confuse, frustrate, and impact parking areas. Putting in landscape islands or small curbs between bike lanes and sidewalks is not aesthetically pleasing and just plain a waste of money. The current designs that are going out for bid show some of these features, and we are against these designs on Newport Avenue. If you drive down Long Beach Avenue, as directed by City Council, so that one can get a feel for that design, you will see sandbags lining many portions of the decomposed granite areas. I cannot fathom how these designs will improve homeowners' value or the safety of the citizens in Grover Beach. You have to be able to walk down those, and if you have obstacles, you're going to have people tripping on those. Rain gets in there, and it causes culverts and drainage, and it's just not a good design. I was also told that Long Beach has these street designs, and I can't even imagine wanting to move to Long Beach as opposed to Grover Beach. The designs that you have for all of Newport make me want, as a homeowner, to move out of Grover Beach. It's just not really a good idea. And on one other note, we have a lot of traffic, foot traffic at night from homeless people or people that are casing houses in our area, and we've had the house next door to us broken into, and things broken off our front yard, our wall, our car is broken into, and the way you have your streets designed with landscaping and parking your vehicles out further in the street away from your property only encourages people to break in. Landscaping encourages people to hide, and it just gives. Just gives them an opportunity that we feel that we don't want to see. Okay, that's it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wanted to speak on this item? Please come forward and state your name for the record, please. And when you have a moment, fill out a blue speaker slip just so our city clerk can capture the names of the folks that have spoken this evening.
Okay. My name's Alana Reynolds. I live in North Grover, not on Newport. Up until a few months ago when my dad passed away, he was 91 years old and had just passed his license again, continued to drive. Backing out of a driveway and having planters and curbs in the road when you're trying to back out a pickup truck and then go forward onto the road safely is a risk, it's a hazard, and it's something to get run into. I was in a Tascadero before. I call them gardens in the middle of the road. They were a hazard. They were in the way, and it took away from our roadways to drive on. The couple that just shared, I drive down Newport, I drive down Saratoga, I drive down 8th, I'm all over, just kind of take different routes when I go to the store. And thinking about curbs, swerving, they become more of a hassle and an irritation. I agree with keeping the roads wide, but curbs and planters in the pathway is a way to trip. If it's pouring down rain and it's dark, it's something to run over, and I think it's more risky, and I don't think the prettiness of the planter is worthwhile with the risk it involves. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Anyone else like to come forward and comment on this item? Seeing no one else come forward, I will bring it back to the council for discussion and deliberation, and just to kind of set the set the tone with respect to that. Obviously, there's a number of people that live on Newport, and the public hearings that we had throughout this item did show a diversity of opinions. And we've heard some of those opinions this evening, but there were also other opinions of folks that live on Newport that we were trying to capture as many of those diverse opinions and putting together a street that was a success from beginning to end in a couple different ways. So safety, traffic speeds, capturing bike lanes and parking, and then also trying to provide the most economical approach for construction of this roadway and then also maintenance of the roadway as a whole. So with that, I'll turn to my colleagues and see if there's any discussion or comments.
I did have one follow-up question just based on the comment that there are sandbags on Long Branch. Has there been a drainage issue because of these planters or?
Mayor, if yes. You want me to ask questions as we go? Okay.
Yes, please.
So yes, there are about four blocks, primarily on the north side, in fact, entirely on the north side of Long Branch, where in developing that design for Long Branch and narrowing the street, the planters slope toward the sidewalks. And there are a couple situations where there's enough runoff generated by rather large driveways, one in particular. It's a multi-unit apartment complex with a fairly large parking area that generates a significant amount of runoff. And it, for whatever reason, doesn't stay in their driveway and exit to the driveway. It channels out through one of our DG planter areas. So what you're seeing right now is just a quick stopgap measure, get us through the rains, and then those sandbags will come up, and we'll have some minor corrective actions to that. That DG, for example, in the Newport design, all of the DG will have a binder, so it's a lot tougher. And also, there's really no location here where the drainage is rooted across that. Whereas on Long Branch, because of the street configuration, there was kind of no way around it. We ended up having some areas where the drainage, a small amount of drainage, runs between the edge of the sidewalk and the planter. But like I said, those will be repaired and the corrective actions will be taken. It should be a relatively minor fix.
So. Okay. So another question that came up was on this particular section in the low DG planters, backing up into the street, is there a possibility or was thought given to perhaps putting curve returns or curves or chamfers on those rather than having 90-degree edges to those to what would be the planters?
No, had not considered it. Okay. It's certainly something we could contemplate.
Okay. And are those anticipated to be 6-inch curbs? Okay.
Yeah,
if I could ask a follow-up question to that. I thought at one point the reason we had wanted to put planters or the additional DG was because there was so much grant funding possibly coming down the line if we were able to retain rainwater. So I'm not sure, but if there's not a specific reason for planters, so you would be suggesting something more like one of those kind of mounds where if you did hit it with your tire, you'd kind of get a reminder like don't drive here, but you wouldn't get damage. Okay.
That could be an option. I was actually that's more of a mountable curb. I was actually thinking of a 2-foot radius curb, so it's not a pointed curb, but rather a radius. So, but perhaps a mountable curb might be another option.
I wouldn't be opposed to something like that. I mean, the planters are a nice idea, but I also just see it either making work for the homeowner or work for the city or work for a committee of people in the city. If we could make it a nice way where it's just a, cement or part of the road, it might be less work for everyone.
And actually, kind of following on that, my thought was planters or plantings in those would be an encroachment permit, so because it is within the public right-of-way. So there would need to be some policy discussion if we did go in that direction. So any
I wanted to follow up on what you'd said, because it is a concern backing out. I mean, people could back in and drive out straight, but that is a learning process too. And I'm wondering, I thought you were talking about, rather than having 90-degree corners on the planters, maybe rounding off the planters so that you had a further sight, better sight coming out than if they were corner, you know, hard 90-degree corners. Is Correct. That what you were yeah. thinking?
Actually, that was what I was thinking, but then Mayor Pro Tem Shaw indicated a mountable curb, and so if we did potentially provide some direction to do both of those options, that might be it may not solve the concerns of the lanyards, but it
might not solve them, but it'll help.
Right.
Just to clarify on a point, when he was talking, Mayor Lee was talking about the curbs for the parking with the buffer zone of the bike lane. And I see, like, for example, between like 9th and 10th where that's happening. If you have areas where the driveway is open and you have people parking in between the driveways, for example, like right in front of 954, for example, you're backing up over the bike lane, which is normal, and then into the road. But if you have cars parking right there, does it, I mean, is there a cause of concern for viewability of oncoming traffic? I feel like having it backed even further would have some visibility issues, or was that not really a consideration? I could just...
So...
Does that make sense? When you have the car separated from the property so much?
When you think about it and you think how different it is in many ways in appearance from what we typically see, yeah, it initially kind of feels like, well, that would be interesting. I'm going to back up and I'm going to have to back up past a car to be able to see the travel lane and to back in the street. But that's what you do every day anyway. I mean, there's cars parked along the curb. So you're currently negotiating your driveway, your landscaping, the sidewalk, so pedestrians, fences, then cars, and then ultimately maybe even a bike lane outside of that, and then ultimately backing into the roadway anyway. So really, if you think about what you're doing as a driver, it's pretty much the same. It's just a little bit further than it was before.
My commentary on this is basically that street has so many ins and outs that people are accustomed to using, and there just is no way to do one design that is going to fit exactly for each home on that street. And so I think we need to go with what is the best overall design that we can find. And this seems to be the best we've got.
With that, this is a receive information on the final design and provide policy approval on the design. So unless there's...
Could I make one more comment?
Of course.
One of the things that occurred to me that we didn't really discuss in the benefits, and there's a lot of advantages, and it's a huge job and a very long street, and kudos to all of you who worked so hard and really achieved quite an amazing feat with all of this. One of the biggest problems we have right now is water. And whenever we have hardscapes, that water just flows down the street into the ocean, and we don't get it back into our aquifer. And for a long time, 60% of our water came from our wells. And we've got the most incredible, we're on sand dunes. So water that we can, where we don't have permeable surfaces, that water really does come in and support all of us. And so what we're doing here is we're taking out a lot of that hardscape and creating a more permeable design, which for a street that's a mile long, that's a significant amount of permeable space where we're able to recapture water and we couldn't before. And if nothing else, that alone is, to my mind, a good reason to do it. So I just wanted to say I'm really happy to see that that the design was created that way also.
Good point.
I'll echo those comments. Actually, when I found out from the city manager that we were going to be looking at this again, I just said, oh, no, this is our fifth public meeting discussing this, and I really do appreciate everyone's comments. But I think at the end of the day, if we keep tweaking and tweaking and tweaking and tweaking, my neighbors on Newport are never going to get a new street. So I think that this, they have just done above and beyond of trying to accommodate so many people's opinions. And I do agree, it's going to be different and it's going to be take some getting used to. But I think that was also part of the point, because once that street is straight and actually paved, I mean, I'm guilty of going pretty fast on it now. I'll probably be flying with my minivan if I didn't have some chicanes or something. So I think at the end of the day, we're going to get a smooth street where we don't have to go over to the other side of the street just to make it through the potholes. That I think we just need to get moving and at this point trust our experts and our staff. And it really is a nice-looking design from what we can see. So thank you, guys.
So with that in mind, I'm hearing consensus of the council. So is there a consensus to also include a potential softening of curbs and mountable curbs on the on what would be the decomposed granite planters?
If so, it's possible to do without too much additional expense or delay.
Mm-hmm. And are you including rounding those 90-degree corners to create the sight distance?
Okay. Yes. Yes, that was. Thank you for that reminder. So with that, I think you have clear direction. So any other direction that you need from us?
No, sir. I believe we have the direction of the council. We'll be working with our team to finalize the tweaks to the design and move this forward to construction bidding so we can get this from the design board into reality. We're aiming to bring the award of a construction contract to the council this spring, with construction to begin by the summer.
Very good. And with that, I will just echo the comments that were up here. Is that thank you for the design team, and thank you for the community for being involved in the process. As you see, we have taken a number of diverse opinions and tried to fashion a street improvement plan that not everyone is going to be happy, but I believe Newport will be a safer street, will be a more developed street from parking and from bike safety, as well as the traveling public there. So with that, we will close this item, come back towards the council for our next item, which is...
Before we start, I need to recuse myself.
Okay.
I'm sorry to interrupt you there.
It's on.
I could be considered to have a conflict of interest because I do operate Airbnb out of my home, even though it's in a commercial district, not residential R1, but I'm on in an abundance of safety and integrity, I'm going to recuse myself, although I will exercise my First Amendment right to speak during public comment.
Okay. Thank you. Very good. Thank you for that, and we'll give Councilmember Peterson a moment to leave the dais as we proceed to our next item, which is our short-term rental regulation policy direction. So with that, I will turn it over to our city manager for introduction and probably introduction of our community development director.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Just very briefly, we're pleased to bring forward to you tonight a policy discussion on short-term rental regulation. This is an item that is in our work program for this year under the council goal of neighborhood preservation. This is an item that has been discussed quite at length in various conversations, in various goal-setting discussions, and we're very pleased to bring this forward to the council tonight and the myriad of different issues that are involved in this complex topic and seeking your direction on how to proceed this evening. I'd like to introduce Bruce Buckingham, our Community Development Director, to take it from here.
Good evening, Mayor, members of the council. So just to start with a little background on this item, in your current 2018-19 council goals under neighborhood preservation, it does state does include regulating short-term rentals in the city. Short-term rentals, or STRs, I'm going to call them STRs, are also commonly referred to as vacation rentals. That is basically the definition is a rental of a residential unit for less than 30 consecutive days, and as a result of that, you pay transient occupancy tax, or what I'll refer to as TOT. So short-term rental is differentiated from a long-term rental based on that time frame. The long-term rental is 30 consecutive days or more, a month approximately, and those are not subject to the payment of TOT. So as you're well aware, the city does not currently have an ordinance or any regulations regarding vacation or short-term rentals, and that's the reason we're here tonight. So again, just for background purposes, in 2011, the council did consider adopting a short-term rental ordinance, but it did not take action at that time. Since then, the number of STRs in the city has increased, and so have the reported complaints about the operations. Host Compliance is a firm that tracks short-term rentals for a lot of local agencies. We've had contact with them, and they estimate that there are currently about 100 short-term rental listings in the city. So we took their little map and we overlaid these little pins on the approximate location of those current listings in the city. And just a real quick orientation here. So this is Grand Avenue. Here's Highway 1. And here's Oak Park on the east end of town and Farrell Road. Again, I will stress that these are approximate locations. They're not to, they don't identify a particular lot or home. So just moving on, potential benefits of a short-term rental regulations. Adopting an ordinance would establish standards to regulate STRs. That would specifically be in mind to designed to mitigate any neighborhood impacts with some tools that I'll talk about in a minute. It would also establish a permitting process that would allow for the revocation of a permit if an STR operation is not in compliance with the regulation. So it gives some teeth if someone is not operating in compliance. It also would be very clear about the requirement to pay transient occupancy tax. And it would increase tourism really by just increasing the sheer number of short-term lodging opportunities. And also would eliminate the uncertainty of whether short-term rentals would be prohibited. We do get a lot of calls, and one of the questions is, will they be prohibited? Will they not be? And that may be influencing what people do. So potential negative impacts of short-term rentals change the neighborhood character by allowing STRs. That could diminish long-term rentals and or owner-occupied residences in the community. Could create nuisance issues such as noise, parking, and traffic, especially since that seems to be concentrated with the usage on weekends. Also, persons staying in short-term rentals may be less likely to be good neighbors because they simply just don't know their neighbors or not familiar with them. And finally, it could decrease the number of residential units available for long-term rentals. So if the council elected to move forward with a short-term rental ordinance, staff would suggest the following goals as part of ordinance creation. Minimizing potential impact, negative impacts on STRs on neighborhoods kind of goes without saying. That in turn would help preserve the character of residential neighborhoods, which can again be a concern. Provide for reasonable use of property, ensuring the standards are not overly cumbersome. Ensure that STRs operate in compliance with the requirements, having some teeth again in the ordinance. And finally, provide efficient enforcement, including adequate fines for non-compliance. So tonight, basically, the council has three policy options to consider regarding short-term rentals. Move forward with drafting an ordinance that would regulate short-term rentals. Second, take no action, which would really continue the existing practice of not regulating STRs. Or take action to prohibit STRs. On that note, we would provided you with a nice little memo from the California Coastal Commission. They're very clear that they do not support complete bans because it does limit public recreation access consistent with the Coastal Act. So if the council does decide to move forward with an ordinance to regulate SDRs, there are many tools that can regulate SDRs. But really, we would ask you tonight to focus on, or at least initially focus on, two of the most important issues, and that's the location, where would you allow these in the city, and the type of SDRs to allow as well. And I'll touch on that a little bit more here shortly. So location, several, really there's a myriad of options on where to allow them. You can do it just simply by zone, commercial zones, residential zones, single family, multifamily, all zones in the city. You can also create an overlay zone or basically define a specific geographic area so it wouldn't be limited by zoning but by a predetermined area in the city. And also you could limit this just to the coastal zone, again, being consistent with the Coastal Commission's desire to not ban them outright in the coastal zone. So just a few things the council may want to consider, keep in mind when thinking about different zones to consider. All of the city's commercial zones allow residential uses as part of mixed-use projects. But there are also non-conforming single-family residences in those commercial zones, and the best example of that is the LeSage Mobile Home Park. Though it's 61 mobile homes, I believe, it's the technical zoning is coastal visitor serving. It's a commercial zone, so therefore they are non-conforming residential uses. In contrast, single-family residential zones obviously contain mostly single-family residences. We do have a small but increasing number of accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, in our single-family zones. And then finally, multifamily residential zones in the city, that means really R2 and R3. Though they typically, because of that increased density, allow PUDs, plan unit developments, condominiums, and apartments. We are somewhat unique in Grover Beach in that we still have a lot of single-family homes in those R2 and R3 zones. Simply homeowners that have decided never to intensify the number of units on their lot. So just talking about location and context, the same map you saw earlier, but this black line represents the coastal zone. So you can see that there are quite a few in the coastal zone currently. A little bit hard, but the lightest areas are the R1 zones, a large area north of Grand Avenue, R1, and South Grover, south of Grand Avenue, you have R1 zones here and further south as well. The R2 zones are this slightly more yellow color, and then the R3 zones are the brown areas, primarily adjacent to the Grand Avenue corridor. So one thing that's obvious from the map is you can see that we have existing STRs in all zones, commercial, residential, single family, and multifamily. So again, I mentioned the types of short-term rentals, and there's really two ways of differentiating them. First, I'll just say most cities do allow short-term rentals for both owner-occupied and non-owner-occupied. Some cities, though, have limited those STRs to just owner-occupied residences, which is commonly referred to as a homestay. So, again, since you have an owner-occupied residence, that homestay allows the resident to rent a portion of the residence while maintaining the presence of having that homeowner on site. And finally, I think it goes without saying that homestays are less likely to have negative impacts on neighbors. So then based on that, really there are several options on the types of STRs for the council to discuss, allowing them for both the owner-occupied homestays and non-owner-occupied, or just allowing them in the homestays or owner-occupied areas, or finally, allowing STRs citywide, but you could differentiate which zones or areas you wanted each particular type. You could say some would be homestays and some could be non-owner occupied. So In the staff report, we elaborated a little bit on different types of regulations that are common tools that are included in citywide ordinances or say other cities' ordinances. I just list a few that are in the staff report, and the council can give us direction on any of these. Limitation on the number of STRs, either citywide or by distance. So, again, some cities just put a cap, only 200 in the city. Others have said to avoid a concentration, to have 50, 100, 300 feet between the short-term rentals. You can regulate the length and frequency of stays. You can establish minimum on-site vehicle parking requirements. You can require contact persons and neighborhood notification for any STR that's in operation. And finally, procedures for handling complaints, violations, determining fines are all important to include in an ordinance. As far as public participation, then, moving forward, there are several options for the council to consider. One would be first to just allow public comment through our normal ordinance process, which requires Planning Commission public hearing as well as City Council public hearing. The council could also conduct one or more public workshops to solicit input. That could be concurrent prior to or concurrent with drafting the ordinance. And finally, the council could create some kind of task force with key stakeholders that would ultimately provide a recommendation to the council. Then finally, just touching on fiscal impacts, there are approximately 40 STRs that voluntarily submit TOT revenue to the city. That is estimated to be $69,000 in the last 12 months, and that was at our 10% TOT rate. Based on Measure L that was passed in November, that TOT rate is now 12%. So just projecting that same $69,000 would be $83,000. So staff estimates the TOT revenues could double, but that is based on the direction we received tonight or an ultimate ordinance that's adopted, whether you the types of STRs or limitations on the areas, all those things could affect future revenues. And finally, some type of annual license fee would cover staff time for permitting and consultant costs to monitor activity. So in conclusion, pending the council's direction on the type of public participation, the council has the following options to consider: direct staff to prepare an ordinance to regulate STRs citywide, direct staff to prepare an ordinance to regulate STRs in a specific area while prohibiting them in others, continue the current practice of not regulating STRs, or other alternatives as the council sees fit. Last thing I would add, that we did receive a correspondence that you do have in front of you from the Golden West Gardens Architectural Committee. So with that, staff's available for questions.
Thank you for that presentation. We'll start any questions to my right. Ms. Lance?
None at this time.
Ms. Nichols?
I really appreciated that memo from the Golden West Family Group, because we do have a lot of apartment complexes and PUDs that are under CC&Rs and that sort of thing. So that definitely has to be taken into consideration in building this.
Council, may I interject one thing? Zoning ordinances generally don't supersede CC&Rs. CC&Rs are privately recorded deed restrictions that are on individual pieces of property. Usually you'll find them in PUDs. To the extent that zoning allows a certain type of use, that those CC&Rs preclude, the CC&Rs would trump or basically take precedent over the zoning ordinance. So for all intents and purposes, you really don't have to consider that as an issue that's before you tonight. They will individually regulate themselves, and there are private actions or rights of actions against other members of a particular community that is subject to those CC&Rs to the extent that they violate them, even if that use or action is consistent with the city's zoning. So hopefully that will help you in your decision-making tonight.
Thank you, City Attorney. Was there...
I think the procedure for handling complaints and violations and citations is super important. With our low staffing, having recourse to get these violations or complaints handled on a really quick basis is going to be problematic. So we need to take that into consideration.
Let's make sure we stay to questions on this, and we'll have time for comments and direction afterwards.
Okay, all right. Then basically I don't have any questions then.
Very good. Mayor Pro Tem Shaw.
I just had one question. I appreciated kind of the glance in the staff report to what some of our neighbors are doing. What does Arroyo Grande do? Where are they in this process? Are they still trying to regulate, or do they have something set out?
You're going to test my memory after reading a dozen of these things. They do allow them citywide. I think just a few years ago they adopted an ordinance. So they allow both homestays and non-owner occupied.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. And I don't have any questions at this time, but I am looking forward to the members in the audience participating with us. But I am going to ask a question here first, in the fact that I've got probably at least half an hour's worth of speaker slips. So if you're okay continuing, or does anybody need a five-minute break?
Okay.
We're okay proceeding? Great. So thank you for your patience as I asked that question. And we look forward to your input on this. I know as being out and about in the city, there's a lot of opinions on this item as well, and we're looking forward to capturing those this evening and hearing from you. So if you haven't given me a speaker slip and you do want to speak, I will give time at the end or bring it forward to and give it to our city manager, and I will add you to the list of speakers. So, but we'll start with Sylvia Bonner, and then that'll be followed by Jeff Bonner. And I'm going to apologize if I pronounce your last names incorrectly. Please correct me as you come forward.
Thank you, Council. Boyer.
Boyer. Sylvia, I apologize. Boyer.
Okay. Thank you for allowing us to speak on the subject. I know that it's kind of a hot topic in, you know, the world that we're in right now. I've lived in Arroyo Grande, Grover Beach, basically my whole life. I'm third generation. So I've watched the different cities grow and change, and tourism has done an amazing change in our Pismo Beach, Avila, Arroyo Grande, and Grover Beach is getting there. And as a homeowner, I think that the short-term rentals are a wonderful asset for us. It gives us the ability to navigate our life. You know, as a homeowner, things come up. You need a new roof, you need to paint, you lose a job, you're trying to keep your mortgage. You have an opportunity to bring someone into your home or rent out your home if you currently can't afford your mortgage for, you know, those hard times in life, which we all have. So I am absolutely for it. As far as zoning goes, I think the zoning is an unfair advantage for the people that are currently in the zone. As far as, you know, putting on just the Coastal Commission, I think it would be fair for it to be all of Grover Beach that's allowed to do it. I think that paying a tax to the city is appropriate. It allows us to manage those operations and to be able to find people that aren't in compliance. Also, I think that it will bring down crime, because I personally have lived next to a drug house, and it took years to get them away from our neighbor. Brought our home values down, because you look up the police reports, I've got calls after calls after calls. It was not easy to sell our house because of it. Fortunately, we haven't had those problems. When you have a short-term rental, they're only there for a couple of days and they're gone. As an owner, it also gives you an opportunity to pick and choose who's going to be there. I don't have to worry about having neighbors who, you know, have children that are, you know, bringing maybe, you know, people I don't want to have over in my neighborhood. So anyway, those are the things that I think that are great. So I would just like you guys to consider that all of Grover Beach can benefit from this, and we can make a little bit of money. Tourism is good for us. People are here to spend money. If they're here spending money, then we have the opportunity to make the city great. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Jeff Boyer, followed by Darlene Deschamps.
Hello, I'm Jeff Boyer, and it's my wife, Sylvia. I'm just going to kind of, you know, reiterate some of the things that she said. I think that, you know, Airbnbs and short-term rentals have been really positive in just what I've seen of the community around. I see things, you know, I see yards kept up better. I see, you know, houses painted. Everything really needs to look good for these to be successful, for someone to be successful in their business. And, you know, they're held accountable through a rating system, through all that. So if somebody's not up to par, you know, they're not going to be getting booked, and, you know, the market will, you know, dictate the demand. So, you know, I've been a homeowner in Grover Beach for about 6 years, roughly. And, I appreciate the fact that I see Grover being an outlier on certain things at times. You know, I mean, the legalized marijuana was one big issue that, you know, where we just kind of departed from what everybody else was doing. And we kind of said, you know, we're Grover Beach, we're going to do our own thing, we're going to do what benefits Grover Beach. And that was the decision, you know, council made on that. And I think it's been working out pretty well. From what I've seen, I mean, we live close by, and it hasn't brought in some of the things that people were really concerned about it bringing in. It's seeming to go smoother than I think a lot of people anticipated. And ultimately, you know, could be debated, but in my opinion, it worked out well for the community. And I think we have a chance to do that here. And, you know, I just caution against regulating for the sake of surrounding areas regulating. You know, we need to look at what works for Grover. I think that all of Grover Beach is very appropriate for using as a tourist destination, because just as a city, we have a lot to offer beyond just the fact that we have the beach. You know, and I think that extending it out throughout the city does help, and it definitely helps things like what my wife said when people fall on hard times. I mean, it just makes that available to them. And, you know, a lot of people do have a lot of really appropriate properties beyond just the small, you know, coastal district of Grover Beach. I mean, and it ultimately comes down to the market is going to dictate the demand. If your property is worth, you know, renting out, it's that's going to be where the business goes. So, you know, if it accommodates that best. So, yeah, that's about all I really have. I just, my main thing that I saw that concerned me was the district relegation. I don't really see that as kind of a fair way to go about it. I am for, you know, being neighborly and, you know, fines imposed for infractions, that kind of thing. Absolutely. Taxes, all that good stuff. But I just want to open it up to everybody. So thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Now we have Darlene Deschamps, followed by Jennifer Breeden.
Thank you, and I do want to say I'm very happy you finally paved Brighton Avenue after 25 years of living there and potholes. I have a PUD, which is an 8-home private driveway, and one of our residents, we've all been there for 20 years or more, and one of the people at the top sold their house and the people that bought it, but strictly to do the Airbnb. They don't live there. They have people coming in for the last 10 months just constantly. I know people want to make money and get money from this, but when it affects your whole neighborhood of 8 houses and you have strangers coming up your little driveway and you don't know who they are, my granddaughter's out playing and people are hauling beer up to the PUD they rented, They're up partying till 2, 3 in the morning, having to call the police on them, talking to the owners. And so, granted, if they do the Airbnb, they need regulations, and they need tough regulations. If you have more than 3 calls from the people that live in the area over a matter of 2 or 3 weeks, they need to lose their license. And basically, that's what I want to say. It's disturbing what has gone on. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. And then just before we get on to Ms. Jennifer Breeden, so for we're going to listen to everybody's comments this evening, and if you do agree, feel free to kind of do jazz hands type of thing. But we are here to allow people to speak, so please let's keep the voices to a limit in the audience, just so we can hear folks speak. So everybody will have an opportunity if they so choose. So Ms. Jennifer Breeden, followed by Anthony Serino.
Thank you for this opportunity. We've waited quite a while to have this. I just wanted to take a second and talk about what it's like to live next to this short-term vacation rental. I'm also part of this eight homes on a private drive. The Airbnb has been operating within the last year. It is not really a residence but a business, as the owners have not lived there since they've owned it. They may have been there a few days or so, but typically it has been rented throughout this time. They do have because it's a large house, they have up to 8 guests per rental. They have a 2-night minimum, and so in 1 month there's a potential to have up to 120 guests, or to us, they're strangers, living next door to us, using our driveway. We 5 of the 8 homeowners there have lived there over 20 years. We know each other. We know who should be around. And since this has moved into to the neighborhood, I personally feel unsafe. There's have been times that I have had to go over at 1, at 2 in the morning and ask the guests to be quiet. I haven't called the police because I thought that, you know, the people are there vacationing and they don't realize they're in the party mode and not realizing that this was a residence. I have also had to take in the trash, that the trash containers have been left out on the streets 10 plus days at a time. Because the owners are not there, they may have people coming in to clean it, but the trash has been an issue. I've called the city a few times. Other neighbors have taken in the trash for them. Other times, trash is not taken out, and it sits there for weeks or days as each person adds to it. We've had animals tip them over. We've had smell, things like that. Also, besides the noise complaints, just not knowing who is supposed to be there. There was several parties throughout the summer when the temperature's warm and the windows are open, and people are in a party mood and they want to be here and enjoy their vacations. We did have a situation where a large rowdy group was there after we had complained. The next morning, there were we had graffiti on our mailboxes, and we had graffiti on we have a private drive sign and graffiti on that. I don't know that that was related, but we hadn't had that before. And I see my time's up, but I thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Next is Anthony Serino, followed by Kitty Otto.
Hi, my name is Anthony Serino, and I've lived here for 32 years in Grover Beach, been a homeowner for 26 years. This spring, my neighbor of 25 years sold her house. I'll be the first to admit that I've been very blessed to have very good neighbors. So the house next to me sold. So we embraced our neighbor. We welcomed him in. I even helped him move his furniture into the house.
And, sir, please keep your comments directed towards, okay. Towards the council. Thank you.
I even helped him move his furniture into the house. He then tells us, me and a couple of the other neighbors, that, he's going to probably use the house to rent to his relatives and close friends. About a week later, my neighbor tells me, Tony, look on Airbnb. He's got his house listed on Airbnb. From that point forward, and what he has listed in his Airbnb, this is a great place. It's a three-bedroom house. It's a great place for two families to meet. Well, guess what? Every time he rents it out every two or three days, there's eight people there. A lot of times, three or four cars. It's a POD. Our driveways are designed for me to be able to back out into his driveway, and the same for me. I always give him that privilege, but because there's four cars over there most of the time, I have to back all the way down the driveway. I'm not going to do it anymore. I am not going to be woke up at 2 in the morning. It's not what I bought that house for. It's to live. I live, for all practical purposes, I live next to a hotel. I have been woke up past midnight time after time after time, and I'm supposed to be cool about it. I'm supposed to be cool when I go over to my neighbors and tell them to shut up. If you guys allow this in our PUD, I am moving. And many of my neighbors will move too. What is the legal complications with us having a private driveway and then all of a sudden there's a slip and fall? Listen, I used to be in insurance. It opens up our homeowners' policies. It leaves us with a bunch of questions. And if you want good quality tax-paying people to remain in their houses, you will not allow this. If you want to give the money away that is made and have it spent up in the Bay Area where the guy lives, do it. But I'm here to tell you that my quality of life and my neighbor's quality of lives have been totally turned upside down. That's not what I owe a $600,000 house for. That's not why my neighbor, my new neighbor who bought after our long-term person finally sold their house, that's not what he bought it for. All this time, we have been naive. We have been stupid because we thought we were protected because we lived in a single-family residence area. We have a full-blown hotel next to us, and I am not going to stand for it, or I am moving.
Okay. Thank you for those.
Sorry. I'm so emotional about it. You guys need to understand.
Understood. Thank you very much. And we're going to ask that certain four-letter words or that turn into eight-letter words are not appropriate in the council chamber. But I appreciate that. Thank you. So next is Kitty Otto, and then followed by Alana Reynolds.
Not in my neighborhood.
Thank you for having me. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you. And you can actually pull that microphone down if you like. There you go.
Yep. We bought our house in Grover, second house we ever bought in 1979, and raised a family there. And for 20 years we lived here. Then we moved away, kept the house though, and moved back. Now we've been here for two more years. And we're on Social Security now, and we do Airbnb. But we have the people into our house, and it's totally different. We just have a little two-bedroom, and they've got the big bedroom, and we've got the little one. And we don't make noises and have parties and, you know, they're in your home. So they're usually on pretty good behavior. We've never had a rowdy guest. And we have people from Europe and intriguing people from China, and, you know, and we, Steve was a travel agent here in Grover Beach. He gives everybody good advice on where to go, what to see, and all that. So it's great for our visitors because he is very knowledgeable about traveling and loves it. Anyway, we think because Grover has a need for housing that I can't help to say this, but if you have, you know, just a room or two to rent in your house, much better than occupying a house that won't go to a resident, you know, if you want to rent it. And it's better for Grover Beach, too. We already have so many houses bought as vacation homes from folks from the valley that have to get away from the heat and come periodically and on the weekends in summer. And anyway, we love Airbnb. It's really a help to us because of our income level. Make that little extra bucks. And people enjoy it. We enjoy them, too. And so, how to say this? Instead of, there would be a good way to say it, but if you wanted to just limit the ability to do it to people who are just doing a room or two, I think that would be a lot better. We do have a house across the street that has been rented out like that, and people are noisy, and other neighbors have complained about it, and, you know, but nobody ever has complained about us. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for those comments. Next is Alana Reynolds, followed by Steve Otto. Sorry to separate the two Ottos. I apologize for that.
Thank you. In about 1990, I ran a youth hostel out of my home in San Luis Obispo. I had people from 49 countries and over 4 summers, a lot of visitors coming in, spending a lot of money locally. There was never a complaint. Yet all school year long, there was constant complaints with the college students. I'm on the next door email group in local Grover Beach. I see more complaints about disrespectful neighbors, people complaining about neighbors and loud people, than I do the complaints to Airbnb. And the stories we heard tonight are, of course, horrible, and nobody should have to do that. Right now I have an engineer through Airbnb renting from me for 2 months, works at Diablo. I've had nurses that stay for 3 months. Again, that's not short-term rental. It's convenient. My dad passed away. I can't afford a $3,000 payment. And I'd much rather have somebody part-time. If there's a problem, I can get rid of them very easily. If you have a problem with Airbnb neighbors, call Airbnb. As an Airbnb host, we will get shut down if we have complaints. So for all of you that can, Airbnb stands behind theirs. Airbnb collects taxes for a lot of San Luis County, Oceano, Avila, I think Cayucas, Cambria. So if it's about the 12% tax, they will collect it from each person if it's less than the 12 days. I agree. In my case, I'm renting them out of my home. I have never had loud music. The only complaint I had is I told them no smoking. They were smoking in the backyard. When it comes to loud neighbors and parties, the hosts need to be complained. I agree with Barbara that we really need, if there's 3 or 4 complaints in a year, they need to be shut down. But for the rest of the people, I have marketed very carefully, no partying. If somebody says we've got 5 people, they're coming in, haven't seen each other in a long time, I will call them and say, this is not a party house. If you are loud after 10 o'clock, not only will I show up, so will the police. So if you're here for a party, don't come. So the people that are complaining, the owner of those homes needs to be the person that needs to be stopped. I've met a lot of wonderful people. I've had people, again, from many, many countries. I've sent them up and down Highway 1, send them to the butterflies, send them, they love California Fresh. They're out to the restaurants. They spend a lot of money here. They go to the outlet malls. So I think having the extra tourists here is fabulous. So I agree with that. I couldn't live in my home if I didn't have a room I'm renting out. Right now, I've been fortunate to do it mostly over 30 days, but having the opportunity to do it short term would be great. When I first came here and went to the city, I said, what if I want to rent short term? And they said, we haven't messed with it. And that's what the council said is, it's not a big deal yet. So it's like, okay, so as soon as I heard about this, I'm here for this. But I am in favor of it. If there's complaints, shut them down. and where people are running it out of their home or a neighbor home that is, if there's no complaints, I don't think any of us have a problem with it, and we'd love the tax. Thank you for considering us.
Thank you. Next speaker, Stephen Otto, followed by, I'm going to say Barrett Brown. Okay, thanks.
My name is Steve Otto, and Kitty stole my thunder, but I'm going to plow ahead anyway. As we live at 575 North 12th Street, and we've owned the same property, as she mentioned, since 1979, 40 years. We raised our five kids here in Grover Beach. It was Grover City then, of course. After retiring 2 years ago, we moved back into our two-bedroom garage apartment while continuing to rent out the front house, the main house. We live on a fixed income. Beginning last spring, we started homestays with Airbnb, renting out our spare bedroom to visitors. In this short time, we have hosted many dozens of visitors to the Central Coast, so many international visitors, including Germans, French, British, Irish, Canadians, Chinese, Koreans, Indians, Japanese, among so many others from the USA, too. Always we tell our visitors about the great things to see and do in the Five Cities area, first and foremost, Grover Beach. With our Airbnb homestay experience, we've had the opportunity to earn some much-needed extra income. As the city develops a regulatory ordinance, I would urge the council to not unduly burden what is our little small business with heavy fees and operating regulations. That is beyond paying the TOT and perhaps securing a business license. Thank you.
Next is Barrett Brown, followed by Janae Brown.
Again, my name is Barrett Brown, and I'm actually a California broker, and I'm also president of the Pismo Coast Association of Realtors. A couple of things I'd like to say is that I don't know that the home dictates, or the way that the home is, dictates what kind of neighbor you're going to have. I lived in Cypress Ridge in a gated community in a very expensive home, and I had the worst neighbor in the world living right next to me. I couldn't change that situation. Part of the problems with over 30-day rentals are tenant rights as well. And once you have a bad tenant that's in that kind of situation, it's also extremely hard to have that person removed. I don't think it's so much the problem of short stay that or short-term rentals that creates the problem. It's the people who come to use those particular properties. So I think that the city has to have the teeth to be able to enforce what happens in those homes, and that the owners absolutely have to be responsible for what goes on in that home if they are going to operate it in a short stay manner. I do know Pismo Beach just did what they did. I think it's distinctly two different situations. Pismo already had an area that was designated as a short-term stay area. And for those folks that are not familiar with it, it was from Addy Avenue kind of on up to where the Contiki was, and from the freeway down to the beach. And so for many, many years, somebody who would buy in that neighborhood or in that area knew that they could go ahead and do short-term rental. And they depended upon doing that because many folks want to come from maybe the valley and have a second residence here, but they're not going to use it all the time. So they do want to have some way to go ahead and offset the cost of that. And many of those people want to eventually retire here because, obviously, we live where people want to come and vacation. We do live in paradise. So a couple other things I would also mention is that as things are going to change, it's important to let our community know, the realtors know, that are interfacing with people that are going to buy in the future, that things are going to change because they have been told for many, many years there is no regulation on short-term rentals. Now if things start to get regulated, it's important that future buyers know that before they go ahead and think that they can continue on with business as normal. The other thing I would also offer is, please, as things move through, I, as a realtor in the area, I absolutely support all property rights. And the gentleman that talked that was very passionate about what was happening in his neighborhood, I absolutely feel that pain, and he should not be going through that. But yeah, no one should have to go through that, and that's part of property rights as well. So, again, as things change, please let us know. We want to make sure that our community can let buyers know in the future the changes that have been made, because it's going to make a big difference in property ownership. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you for your comments. And next is Janae Brown, followed by Nanette Batrashi. I apologize, Dratronica. So I'm sure I got that incorrect, but Ms. Brown.
Actually, my name is Janae Brolin.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. If you look at my writing, it's probably not great. Thank you very much for letting us get up to speak. I had nothing written. I'm sure I'm going to be a little repetitious, but I just want to tell you my experience a little bit. I do live in a coastal zone area where a lot of those red little balloon dots are. And when I bought my house 7 years ago, I bought it from the owner and his partner. It was a vacation rental. My neighbors were thrilled to find out that I was actually moving in. And great time for quite a few years, but several years ago, the neighbor in front decided to make theirs a vacation rental. And I went to them and I said, wait a minute, you thanked me for making my house a full-time resident, and now you're going to do this to us. And I will tell you that the my privacy has been interrupted. The trespassing onto my little piece of property, because we're a PUD. We have two homes in the front, two in the back. I am the back. The one in front of me is the rental. You know, I've had to ask people to please get off my property. They're allowing their kids to kick soccer balls into my newly painted and redone garage door. Bicycles, the noise. Fireworks have been shot off from the roof because we have the big roof patios on top. I found a rocket up on mine from when they were doing fireworks up there. The owners of that house have allowed a fire pit, one of those little portable ones, to be up there. They're burning real wood. When the owners are there, they're not there often, but when they are there, I know that they're conscientious about keeping that little top on it. These people are opening it. There's sparks flying all over. I'm surprised the little wood apartments on the other side of the street haven't burned up by now or a tree caught on fire. It's been very dangerous. Obviously, a lot of drinking. A lot of the people are bringing their big pickups with their toys. They use our long driveway to park vehicles until one of the other neighbors or myself say this is a fire, you know, road basically for the homes in back. You cannot park here. Trash cans are left out. These owners actually do use a vacation rental service. I don't find them very appealing or very, very professional. Like I said, trash cans are left out. For a while, I couldn't understand why I had all this trash and debris in my front yard. I was home one day and realized that the gardener was taking his blower and blowing everything from the front house into my yard. And I went out and I said, what are you doing? This is not right. So as far as the, you know, the short-term rentals, they really have to be some regulations put to it. I think the vacation rental companies also need to be looked at, because maybe not all of the ones that are out there should be here in Grover Beach. And, you know, as far as the homestays, I think that's amazing. The homestays would be great because the owner is there and they are regulating things. But not when you are living in a home and all of a sudden everything around you has changed because you have people running in and out. And you know the story. There is a story about the house, and it happens to be the way the windows are situated in the master bathroom. And one of the windows is in the shower. And let's put it this way. Unfortunately, one night I came home and realized there was someone in that shower with the lights on behind it. You could see them. Even with the frosted glass, I asked the owners of this house to please cover the windows, and they refused. So that's my experience. But thanks for listening to us. Really appreciate it. And if you decide to do a committee with residents, I volunteer.
Thank you, Ms. Brolin. Next is Nanette. So, and then followed by my last speaker slip is Debbie Peterson. But if there are other folks who do want to speak, we'll give you an opportunity as well.
Okay, my actual name is Nanette Bavaro-Latronica. That's what you have me down as.
Sorry, I apologize.
And I have limited voice. Anyway, after observing full-time rentals around me, I will never, ever have a full-time rental because I've had problems with them. The problem with a full-time rental is, you know, it takes a process to get them out. My vacation rental is not rented very often because I am very strict. And I do have a copy of my contract that you're welcome to look at. And it does state that, first of all, no smoking, no animals unless it's cleared with me. Parking, you have to park in the garage only unless you have a visitor. And there is one parking space next to the garage that is designated for you. In my home, and, you know, Debbie has been there, she has seen that I have rules in my home. There is a process. You have to interview the people that are coming into your home, even though Airbnb goes on ahead and lets them get, you know, lets them be accepted or denied. You have to use judgment. Also, I have a cleaning staff, a maintenance man. I employ 3 people to keep my house maintained. It's always clean. You're welcome to come to it anytime. I invite you. But it comes down to rules and regulations and common sense. As an owner, I tell whoever is renting from me, I'm 3 hours away, but I have a housekeeper that is 3 blocks away, and she and her husband will be over. I provide every one of the people around me with my email, my phone number, my cell number, and I tell them, one problem, call me, and I will have someone there, and then I'm on my way. I've never had a problem. I only had problems when I had agencies taking care of my home. I had to take over, and I come to Grover Beach often. I sometimes spend about a week a month here, and I enjoy interacting with the Grover Beach community, and I have learned that when I market this, I don't say, oh, it's by Pismo. No, it's not by Pismo. We're Grover Beach, and this is a neat town, and there's so much to offer. I would like for us to really get more involved with tourism, yet be able to keep, you know, a home atmosphere. I would love to live in my house, but that man back there doesn't want to move from Las Banas. I love my home, so of course, I really want to maintain it. Thank you so much. Do you want my contract?
Yes, if you want to give a copy to the city manager, so if you would. So next, Debbie Peterson, thank you for joining us. And then also, I did get one more speaker slip, Penny Bennett.
I have recused myself as a council member because the Fair Political Practices Commission might consider me to have a financial conflict of interest. So I'm here as an individual exercising my First Amendment right to speak as a member of the public. And I know that San Luis Obispo and Pismo Beach have some pretty draconian rules. And I just want to say, as others have, we're not San Luis Obispo. We're not Pismo Beach. We're a friendly bedroom community, and historically people have had modest beach homes here. And I want to give you 3 examples of people who are operating Airbnb from their home. And I'll talk first about me. And in 2017, I had a serious car accident. I couldn't work for a year. My small disability allowance, my savings, my selling my investments wasn't enough to pay the rent, to cover food, to shelter, high medical expenses. So I survived by renting rooms in my home. Now, that made it possible for me to pay the mortgage and the property taxes and keep my home. My next door neighbor is a young working mom, and she has a 2-year-old and a 2nd child on the way. Her husband is deployed for 6 months. So renting their modest, very modest, little Grover Beach home out as a vacation rental until he returns allows them to keep their home, but also allows them to stay with her parents so that she has someone there for the birth of their 2nd child and to take care of their existing child as he's away. And then the other one I'll call Anne. And Anne is a baby boomer like me, and she was able to stop work to stay and care for her 90-year-old father in his Grover Beach home because she could rent out rooms. And the advantage to that was that he could keep his home and he could be with his family until he passed in 2018. One other thing to consider, and we're hearing there are 100, I suspect there are probably 150 out there, but one other thing to consider is that all of us have hired cleaners. Chris, Dawn, Elizabeth, and her daughter clean for me. We've all hired gardeners. Donna and Jerry help me with my garden. And we have handymen, Greg and Robert's son. And I wouldn't have employed any of those people if I didn't have to because I have an Airbnb. The other thing is I wouldn't be keeping it up as nicely as I do on the outside. I wouldn't have made as many improvements if I wasn't actually having to keep it really nice for guests who are spending money there. And we've also all spent considerable money making our homes more hospitable. I've actually improved my home more than I would have otherwise. I've spent quite a lot of money doing that also. And all of these people who come are spending money in Grover, in the restaurants, in the grocery outlets, in the retail stores, in the gas stations. They're supporting Grover businesses. They're generating tax income for the city. And, whoops, I'm sorry, I'm almost out here. So really what I want to say is we're talking about a potential of roughly 300 jobs for the 150 people who are operating their Airbnbs from their homes and also for the people they're employing. And it would be a crushing blow for those families. I'm hoping that we can strike a balance for equal taxation and for equal good neighborliness. Thanks.
Thank you for your comments. The last speaker slip I have this evening is Penny Bennett.
Thanks. My name is Penny Bennett. And let me first of all say to the folks that have had some bad experiences, I'm certainly sorry for that. But I think they make the case better than anything that there has to be some regulations, more so than those of us speaking in favor. I will say that I recently started an Airbnb business myself, and all of the folks that have spoke, I 100% agree of the benefits. I would say the estimates on income that were shared is probably underestimating, so I think there's a lot of opportunity. I personally provide not only a welcome map, but also you can do like a guidebook. You can recommend businesses. So I know I'm personally, you know, directing my guests to go out and utilize the services. And I will say, too, that by and large, I do give my number to my neighbors. So if there's any complaints, I want to know about it. But again, if there's regulations in place for noises and that sort of thing, you know, any business owner would, you know, be diligent to pay attention to those. And then the other thing that I would say is that I think it's a great opportunity. And the type of guests that I get are from all over the world. And they come to vacation here, and they're respectful, and they follow the rules, or there will be consequences. So I think it's great that you guys are doing this, and I encourage you to have more public hearings as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. That's all the speaker slips I have. Is there anyone else who has a comment that would like to come forward? Come on forward, sir, and state your name, if you would, please. And then I would ask you to fill out a blue slip after you do finish, so that way we can get your name spelled correctly.
My name is Don DeChance. Yes. I've been listening to everybody on both sides of this thing, and all the people that are for them, which I am not, are advertising the fact that they send people to all the local businesses. What are motels for? That's where people are supposed to go when they come here from all your Europe countries and so forth. Go to a damn motel. Don't sit next to somebody's house that they bought to have a nice, quiet residential neighborhood. But think about that, what motels are for. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. So anyone else? Last chance. I'm going to go ahead and close the comment period and bring it back to the council. We still doing okay? Great. Okay, very good. Then we will continue. So I want to turn it over first to Mr. Buckingham, see if there was anything in the public comment arena that you need to clarify, ask questions of us for, and then we will get down into the some of the larger questions that you've posed for us this evening.
I don't have any comment. Okay. I agree with the speakers in general. Regulations are going to go a long ways in ultimately trying to bring most of these situations into compliance. As some speak, some mentioned, you do need to have a good complaint procedure, violation, and fines in place ultimately to incentivize people from being bad actors. So I'd be happy to answer any questions of the council.
Thank you. Thank you for those comments. Any other last-minute questions? Next.
This might be outside of the scope, but for these planning unit developments, as far as housing association bylaws and CCNRs are concerned, and this might be a question for the city attorney, What is the extent? I mean, I used to live in a condo building, and that obviously had CCNRs and bylaws, and we, you know, dealt with this type of thing. But as far as the planning unit developments, where there's 4 to 8, is there any HOA type agreements in place, or is it a case by case basis?
I can tell you in general, most of our PUDs, which are 2, 3, 4 units, don't necessarily have the typical CCNRs. They have maintenance agreements for their shared driveway or basin, but typically the developer that's doing that is trying to create a single-family feel and not having CCNRs as part of that.
Okay.
I will just say that all of the PUDs approved over the last decade or so do have fire lane requirements. They're posted for fire lanes, and that probably does a lot to prevent even guests of people who live there from parking there. But certainly one thing that would need to be part of this ordinance is perhaps for those that don't have marked fire lanes, trying to get that type of an agreement, because that then, again, puts teeth in the ordinance so that if you have a vehicle there, they can be towed.
Okay.
So with that comment in mind, I think let's make sure that before we get down to discussing any terms of ordinances or anything of that nature, our first decision is going to be, or discussion point is to be whether to regulate or not to regulate. But with that, I'll turn it over to City Manager.
Just one quick clarification, or maybe just to add some context. We had an earlier bullet point about the Coastal Commission and what they're looking for. And the reason why that's important is that the Coastal Commission ultimately has the land use authority over the 13% of residential lots in the coastal zone. So whatever action the council takes, if your action is to regulate, to create an ordinance, ultimately the ordinance that is in part of the coastal zone has to go to the Coastal Commission for approval. So there is that additional step or layer, you might say, regarding the Coastal Commission's oversight around what happens in the coastal zone, which is different than the non-coastal zone. So just wanted to emphasize that point as the council considers different areas or different zones.
Thank you for that clarification. So with that, I'll bring it back for, yes.
I was just going to mention, so we created a slide here to regulate or not regulate, and then a list of the potential options for council to discuss.
We have a roadmap, so we like roadmaps. So with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues and see if there's discussion on the first question, which would be, do we regulate short-term rentals or do we not? So I'll start with Councilmember Lance.
I think based on the consensus of what everybody's been saying on both sides, I think regulation is necessary.
I agree.
Yes.
Okay. So with that, and I will concur with that as well, I think the industry is here, and so in order to protect and safeguard the residents of the city as well as the residents' property rights, I think there's an opportunity for us to put some, as a member of the public said, to put some teeth into an ordinance that we move forward with. So,
could I make one comment on the regulation just to give people a little history? And I just got this history myself, having only been up here 4 years. We've been trying to get this done since 2011. So I just really don't want to overdo it and end up again just having to drop it because we can't drop it. It's obviously affecting quality of life. So if I seem like I'm rushing, that's because I want something for people to be able to follow by this summer because I know the summertime is especially problematic. So just giving that background, I want to regulate it. I don't want to beat it to death. I think a lot of other places have done some good work on it already. So let's go.
Okay. So with that, I'm hearing consensus that we do want to draft an ordinance and put in place something that does provide opportunities but provide safeguards. So with that, I'm actually going to turn it over to the city manager briefly that in the fact that we have now decided to go down a path of regulation, realizing we have a number of other decisions. From a timing standpoint and from a process standpoint, what will be our next steps once we get through providing direction this evening? So to Mayor Pro Tem Shaw's point, what is the potential timeframes? Again, we do have to make a decision as to what kind of additional public input or provide public input through our standard process.
Yes, thank you. And I would just say in general that we share the time frame interest that Mayor Pro Tem Shaw mentioned. That's why we brought this forward in early early in the year in January with an interest of having something that is adopted and regulating the space by the summertime, by the tourist high season. So we're prepared to move this forward promptly and quickly based on the council's direction. We do have to do some CEQA analysis, as the city attorney reminds me, and that will be part of our process, as part of the ordinance process. And I will mention that the time frame is also determined by the council's direction on public engagement. We reference a few different models. One model is the traditional engagement process through planning commission meetings, council meetings, public comment, like you heard tonight. Another option is to hold one or more public workshops, community forums that seek to provide information and get some additional viewpoints as part of the forum discussion. Third option is to do what Pismo Beach did, and that's form a committee representing diverse stakeholders, short-term rental hosts, residents who are concerned about the impacts, and coming up with recommendations for the council, all of which can be done. It's a matter of time frame. Either of the latter two options would likely extend that time frame, and we would maybe bring something back by late summer. The first option is something we could bring forward to you by late spring.
Great. Thank you for that synopsis. And with that, that'll kind of be the context for the next round of our discussions. So just as an FYI with there. So having decided to move forward with some crafting of an ordinance here, so next on our roadmap appears to be location of short-term rentals. And I think where staff has kind of left up for us for discussion is there particular areas of the city that we would like to either provide allowance for those uses, or is there discussion on that? So I'll start to my left.
I would rather not try to dice up the city into zones, just because our city within each designation kind of has its own unique pockets and streets. I think I would rather just allow them, but then regulate them heavily. One thing I am wondering if there would be any type to maybe prohibit, do we look at not allowing PUDs because they are so close to each other? I don't know.
And so that'll fall under our type. So let's,
so that's type. All right. So location, yeah. I say let's just let no zones for me.
Any input discussion from on my right, Councilmember Nichols?
Other than the extra permits needed from for the coastal zone, yeah, I agree.
So by agree, no zoning limitations.
Right.
Okay. Councilmember Lance.
My reasoning is similar in that Grover Beach is quite small in square mile radius, and within that there's a lot of mixed use, as was discussed in the different zoning. You know, even though there's multiple residences zoning, then there's also single family homes within that zoning. So if you try and split it up that way, it tends to get maybe even almost more complicated. So I definitely would agree that start with no zoning specifics, but as we move forward in drafting the ordinance, making sure that we provide caveats for high density dwellings and the like.
Okay. So, Bruce, if you could you put up the map showing? Yes, thank you so much. So I'm going to concur with the, at this point, no zoning limitations for locations. Because they are, there is opportunities throughout the city for short-term rentals. I think our next discussion on type, and then our following discussion on that with regards to regulations is going to be how we craft a successful ordinance with that. So, I'll consider continue the uniformity of thought with regards to no zoning limitations at this point. So, I think we're clear on those two items. Now we get down to discussion on type. So if you would, yeah, thank you. And so I'll start to my right this time with Councilmember Lance.
Sure. I was reading and asking questions about what Pismo's been doing, where they have recently, and I know we're not Pismo, we're doing our own thing, we're trailblazers, I get that, but it is nice to reference other cities and how they're doing it and how it's working for them.
So from my knowledge, PISMO has a downtown core, not corridor, what it, core, downtown core, which initially allowed, you know, condos and high density dwellings to be vacation rentals. And then most recently, now they have a second ordinance limiting it to single family residences. So I would want to explore that a little more, looking at, you know, beside from zoning areas, but maybe almost doing something similar in the sense that near the coastal or downtown core area of Grover Beach, where there is more high density dwellings, limiting the type of dwelling to that. I don't know. Not that that comes into zoning, but more so about the type of dwelling, if that makes.
So with homestays versus non-owner occupied, I'm kind of hearing a potentially a willingness to have more of that conversation. Or did I misunderstand? And coastal would be.
Sorry, I misunderstood. I started talking about high density versus single family residences. Okay, two homestays versus non-owner occupied. I think, yes, having that conversation further, I think the non-owner occupied would come in more for for high-density dwellings, high-density residences, and the homestays would be more applicable to primary residences.
Okay. Okay, so non-owner occupied, higher-density homestays, single-family residences, kind of in a if I heard that correctly.
Correct.
Okay, great. Councilmember Nichols.
And to me, the high-density condos, apartment buildings and stuff is the last place we want people coming and going at all times during the year. That would seem to me to be very unsettling for any permanent occupants and very difficult to regulate. Because of the numbers and the come and go attitude of it. So I'm thinking more private residents.
Can I clarify a point on just based on what Barbara said after Councilmember Nichols said after me? I guess my thinking in taking into consideration the condos and whatnot is there's usually the CCNRs and the bylaws and other things that provide protection for those high density dwellings, which is what I was thinking of the back of my mind. As a previous condo owner in Chicago, there was a lot of procedures within our living unit that protected us from the kind of Airbnb things that happen. So that's why I would consider that, because there are secondary opportunities for the condo owners and apartment owners to regulate it themselves within their own community.
Okay. That makes sense.
Okay. Sorry, thank you. I wanted to clarify that point.
Mayor Pro Tem Shaw.
Yeah, I'm very conflicted on this point. Obviously, I think most people can agree the homestays probably aren't an issue. I think if someone's in your home, you are going to be policing them. Non-owner occupied is where I'm having a dilemma, because as always, we're hearing from people who live next to the non-owner occupied ones that are problems. But there's also probably over 100 ones on this screen that maybe they're not a problem. That's why people aren't here. So I hate to, I don't know, I feel like the regulations can regulate, you know, all of these, rather than taking something that could be very lucrative and non-disruptive for someone off the table. I mean, just jumping a little bit ahead, I would be in favor of the strictest regulations. You know, I know in PISMO, if you get one call from a neighbor, you're fined $750. I mean, these are major money, and I would be in favor of that. But I hate to try to delineate and say no non-owner occupied, or because we just have so many unique situations in the city that I'm just not sure if it would apply correctly. That part, I'm conflicted.
Okay. Right. And I'll say I'm conflicted as well, because there are commercial visitor services in areas where there is literally a residence and a business that has been either correctly modified into an Airbnb or another living structure. So there's a, I think there is going to be differing opportunities based upon that. So we've kind of delved into or put our toe into the water of the regulations. So let's have some conversation around that and see if that either solidifies or muddies the water on type of SDRs. And I see our city manager squirming, which is always a sense of for me to ask him a question.
Or, squirm is a subjective term. Just to add just a point regarding the last comment from Mayor Pro Tem Shaw about the Pismo Beach ordinance and the complaints. That's correct. First complaint is $750. Second and third complaints, second complaint, $1,000. Third complaint is a revocation. And then that becomes a code enforcement case. So it's not just a revocation as I had in mind. It's a code enforcement case that is enforced by the city or by a contractor working with the city. So there are teeth in ordinances like that that could be in place should the council enact those regulations to really address the impacts in a very serious manner.
If I could just have him clarify one thing, too. We talked about this offline, and I wanted you to just kind of be able to explain it for the public because as everyone, or not everyone, but people probably have heard, we just got a code compliance officer this year. We hadn't had one for a long time. So what assurance can we give people that if we do put these regulations in place, you know, they will be enforced every single time? Could you just explain the third-party companies that cities are using?
Sure. Well, first I would emphasize that what's in the code gets enforced and gets followed through. To your point, we do have a code compliance officer that handles our code complaints, and they are responded to very promptly, and we address those. What a number of cities have done with regards to STRs is that they contract with a third-party provider to handle the upfront identification of the rental units to make them aware that we have regulations, we have taxation, we have certain procedures that need to be followed, and cities can work with them to send out notices of violation, to enforce the city's codes. And in some cases, they actually set up hotlines where residents can call in if there are complaints, and that it's a 24/7 hotline which gets directed to the city for a code enforcement response. So above all, we enforce our codes, and there are some tools we could use to make sure that these complaints were followed through very promptly.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. So with that is either a third-party compliance or a hotline or something of that nature that provides additional assurances, maybe come back to Community Development Director Buckingham. Bruce, so as we move forward with this, within the ordinance, is there an opportunity for us to also request either administrative use permits, I think it was discussed in here, or some level of use permits process whereby there is a effectively a notification of each of the surrounding neighbors in the sense of a PUD, they're going to be notified of this application and have an opportunity to comment and request conditions of approval or just speak their denial request for that in some level of public comment. So what kind of process have other cities used, and what would we be considering?
So almost all cities basically issue a permit, I'm going to say over the counter. We have a home occupation permit that we do over the counter. But what that permit does is it actually stipulates all of the regulations. Those become the conditions of the permit. We'll have to get more into the weeds, but you know, we have to determine how many bedrooms the unit has. That would then cap the number of guests. We can do that through an on-site inspection. We can do it through a self-certification. But the bottom line is we issue a permit that has all of the conditions or requirements that they must operate under. Again, most cities or a lot of cities now have gone to this as part of that concurrent issuing of the permit. They have to provide the contact responsible party. That's mailed to a radius that's included in part of that ordinance. It provides that contact person that has to be a local person that has the ability to respond and take action as well. So all of those things can be written into the ordinance. The other way that this can be done is requiring some type of public comment period, whether that's a public hearing or receiving comments prior to issuing a permit. The issue with that is that any kind of discretionary permit where you need to make findings, there has to be evidence in the record that there is something that's not consistent with those code requirements or regulations. But in these cases, you're not operating, or you know, looking at the history becomes a little bit problematic. So most cities have not gone that route. It also becomes more cumbersome, and if you're having public hearings, there's costs associated with that. So it's really the latter phase, I should say the first one that I outlined is preferred by staff in the sense that it can be done more quickly. But again, that is the permit, and you must abide by those conditions. And as the city manager mentioned, then we go to a citation or fine process. And again, as an example, Pismo Beach, our current violation for code violation starts at $100. So the idea is by increasing that significantly, you really are creating the teeth in an ordinance. And as also has been mentioned, within most good ordinances now, say X number of violations, some define them as significant versus minor, but again, the council can get into that. The permit would be basically automatically revoked. You know, there can then be an appeal of that, and it can end up in front of a public hearing. But three strikes and you're out, as you heard a number of people mention tonight. That's something that I think they're looking for in an ordinance.
So with that, and I'll see if my council members concur with me. So I think there was the largest concern, as we've recognized, is with PUDs. So, and obviously there is a number of locations that are already operating, so it's not a new business coming into town. And so there may be some history or maybe some course of communications either with the police department or with our code compliance. So I think I would be supportive and for concurrence of a little bit more formalized process for those that are operating, whether it's similar to a PUD to where there is a notification of your neighbors, so it's not strictly an over-the-counter permit, so that if there is already recurring issues or problems with a use, that that the neighbors and the surrounding uses do have an opportunity to provide that input that the city may not have readily available. And so if as we go through, I don't know if there's any concurrence or if I'm off base here.
Well, I would concur with that if it didn't jam up the process, because with a new day, an owner who doesn't care at all may be a very different owner when they're about to get fined $750. So it may not be worth looking back at old stuff as much as it's worth get your permit, but 1, 2, 3, and you're out. I mean, it sounds like some of these mm-hmm. owners would be out in a week anyway. So I just don't want to hold up the permit process, because then we're holding up these people from getting fined. We're holding up everything else. And meanwhile, they're making money like crazy. So I feel like let's get the permits out. Let's start regulating. I wouldn't even limit it by number or distance, because I have heard through sitting on the tourism board, SloCal, that sometimes when you start doing those limits within a neighborhood saying, oh, you can only have them once every 200 feet, neighbors are selling the permits to each other. And it just becomes something that it was not supposed to be, because then you all of a sudden have this limitation. I mean, as I look at this map, and I do know a lot of my street is actually vacation rentals, and it has improved a lot of the look of the houses. That being said, when my neighbors are even out on their balcony, I'm like, oh, no, are they renting out now? Is this going to be a new day? So I worry. I think we all worry about it. So I just think getting the regulation established and maybe not jamming up in the front, but just getting those bad owners, give them their permits and pull their permit. And then they're out.
And I'm going to disagree with that just because of the staff resources that's going to incur as well. So, but I mean, obviously, that's we'll see if what concurrence.
I'm just worried about the resources, and maybe we can learn more of assessing every permit before getting it out. That's the part that worries me.
Okay. I tend to follow a similar trajectory of thinking as. Councilmember Shaw, I think that the bigger impact the more financial impact, the more of the hitting the jugular for some of the owners that are not complying is going to be on the enforcement side. So if there is going to be a allocation of resources, whether there's more resources on the front end versus more resources on the back end, I personally would think that the resources would be better served on the back end in enforcement, giving the the neighbors the opportunity to really see the ordinance and the regulation come to fruition, and yes, not jamming up the process on the front end and opening up the TOT money initially and then revoking it in a kind of three strikes you're out type of scenario.
Okay. Councilmember Nichols.
I feel the same way about that. Do our utmost at the front end, and if they turn out to be bad people, then get them out.
Okay. So with that kind of hearing concurrence there, but perhaps if we do go down that path, let's see if this works. Is one of our internal checks would be obviously with the chief of police to see if there has been active.
How many calls have been there?
So
yes.
just to at least know that
a part of the general regulation process, I think.
Okay, very good. So we'll great. And Bruce, we've lost your roadmap.
If I can just chime in on the last comments there.
Certainly.
Based on some of the, I'll say, pretty egregious things that I'm hearing from the public that's going on next door, and some saying they haven't complained, and we haven't had any regulations in place.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that combination, if we send a notification within 100, 200 feet, I think anybody that has a concern and it's a known issue is going to immediately take note, and if not operating in compliance, we're going to hear those complaints maybe for the first time because we haven't historically heard those. Mm-hmm. So.
Right, they'll have a place to
a place to express that.
Exactly.
Okay. Very good.
It looks like we might be, just before we get our roadmap back, I just wanted to make a quick comment because I know people have felt a lot of frustration with this, and in the meantime, we did put on the Grover Beach website just a list of laws that are applicable today. There are laws about noise. There are laws about bringing your trash cans in, and things that you can call in. And if you don't want to maybe, call the police department, you can call the non-emergency number. And we really do, encourage people to do that because we have no way to know what's going on. And I can only imagine the frustration and feeling. Ordinances about fireworks. Again, you can call about that. So hopefully we'll get this done soon. But in the meantime, if you're having a really bad issue.
Okay. Very good. Very good point. So as we, as our roadmap continues to take shape. So I think we've gotten down into the STR regulations. So I think I heard Councilmember Shaw speak about no limits on number or distance. Is there comments or concurrence? And I'll see if there's anything on length and frequency of stays next. But we'll start with limit of number of or distance.
I think that would probably be kind of difficult to regulate. However, it also concerns me if we have suddenly we have a neighborhood, like in the map it showed really concentrated areas of and then large spaces that are none. I'm not seeing any good reason to say this zone is okay and that zone is not okay. So.
Okay. So if you wanted to add there.
Yeah, just to add, I think, and this was discussed in the memorandum, but even cumbersome, what Councilmember Shaw was saying about you know, potentially the neighbors bartering and trading permits, but also the happening of one person stopping their vacation rental and then having to figure out, okay, how many feet can the next person be? And it turns into kind of a very complicated labyrinth of permit process. So I would concur with both of them that.
Okay. So with kind of, I'm hearing the kind of congealing of where our thoughts and our comments are going is maybe the direction we provide to staff here is it's a, tell me if I get the wording correctly, but a permissible ordinance as our first draft. So with no limitation on number or distance, I'm going to anticipate no length and frequency of stays, not being a factor beyond in accordance with the definitions of short-term rentals as 31 days or less or 30 days or less.
Yeah, that was one area I kind of wanted to ask what you guys all, what other people thought, because it seems sometimes like the most disruptive part is when people are all dragging their stuff in and dragging their stuff out. So on one hand, if you limited it to 4 stays per month, as is suggested in our memo, you may only have 4 weekends a month and at least maybe you'd get a little breather. But then on the other hand, maybe that would make the owner force people to stay 4 to 5 days. And if you have a problematic group, then you're stuck with them longer. Mm-hmm. So I could see that going, as much as we would try to make that better, that may make certain situations worse. So yeah, that's why I think I'm really interested in the next few, the parking, the number of people. I think that and the trash, like those are the meat of what mm-hmm. it seems to be the problem.
Okay. Well, so unless there's any other comments on length and frequency, we'll jump into parking. And so we did recently approve a parking update. So is there, and I'm going to give staff kudos prior to actually them answering this question, in the fact that you probably thought about the short-term rental process during the development of our revamped parking ordinance. So please enlighten us.
Well, the simple answer is we require, I'll say, the standard parking for residential uses. If you have a single-family home, it's a 2-car garage with the 2 spaces in the driveway. And for multifamily, that can be 2 covered or uncovered spaces. And a mixed-use project and along Grand Avenue, it could be as little as 1.5 spaces per unit. Mm-hmm. Do the math there. So the parking is appropriate for the residential use. Certainly, what you can't really or is difficult to regulate is that a person living in a home may have 2 or 3 cars. If you have 8 guests, are they coming in 2 cars or 4 cars? And so, you know, that's difficult to regulate. What some cities, in other words, if you were to require them to park on site, mm-hmm. There are some cities that have actually tried to do that, regulate that the parking must be on the site, must be on the garage, must be in the driveway. Candidly, the feedback I've gotten so far is that's pretty difficult to enforce. You know, whose car is that that's parking out on the street? Is that somebody that's staying there? Are they visiting during the day or are they an overnight guest? So that one is very difficult to say you have to park on site, but certainly requiring either the standard number of residential parking spaces for that particular zone or use on site and that they're available, that could be another key. In other words, we know people are not required to park in their garage. They just have to have a garage. Mm-hmm. As part of this ordinance, you could make sure that the garage is available for parking. So there are some things like that the council could consider.
Yeah, I would like to see us, you know, I think we're trying to encourage building and residence for people, and that's why we kind of lessened our parking requirement. But this is different. These are people making money off their homes, and I think that we need to be strict with the parking, because if the houses on my street are going for over $500 a night. If you're making over $500 a night, you should have to clean out your garage and put the cars in the garage. You shouldn't be adding to the clutter on the street with more cars on the street or getting in people's way. I think you should be required. I would even say maximum, no matter how much space you have, two cars. Who needs to come on vacation with more than two cars? And that means three or four families meeting if it's more than two cars. And I don't know of any homes in Grover Beach where really you should be having three or four families to keep a quiet neighborhood. So I would like to be as strict with the parking as Bruce can find reasonable in other ordinances.
Comments to my right?
She makes a good point.
I think about the enforcement of that being very difficult, in that, you know, as a young traveler trying to get the most for your money and staying at Airbnbs and if there's parking, you know, requirements that, you know, you only have a certain amount of cars and they all have to be on the premises, you find a way to park five blocks away and walk to the premises. You know, there's these kinds of things that are very difficult to regulate, but I am definitely a proponent for ensuring that there is enough parking spots on the premises to be used based on occupancy. I saw, you know, if you have two people per bedroom and there's three bedrooms, then allowing at least three parking spots on site, a car per bedroom. They might not need that many cars, but ensuring that there is sufficient on-site parking, I would definitely be a proponent of.
That would be good.
Yeah, I think, I mean, let's say someone had a six-car garage, then they should be able to have six cars. But if they don't, I don't think they should be allowed to jam up driveways, or especially in the PUD situation, use right. spaces that are not their spaces. Yeah. And as far as enforcement, I agree, it would be hard to say, oh, they walk from five blocks away. But if you're constantly annoying your neighbors by parking in their spots, all they have to do is take a photo and say, look, here's three cars and there should be two. And that I think would help with the enforcement.
And that could come neighbors. Into the complaint procedure.
Yeah, the procedure. So, yeah. And I'm hoping we're not going to have to invent or reinvent the wheel. I'm hoping Bruce can find something that another city has done with parking, but I would just be in favor of the strictest thing you could find.
So I'm hearing somewhat consensus as that's a good starting point. So staff, are you good with that?
Yes.
Component of the direction? I think the next one is probably a slam dunk that we will all agree to require a contact person and 24/7 notification numbers as part of that. So which then gets us, unless...
Yeah, and I really liked what the staff report said, that you have to have a person that can be at the property in 5 minutes, not a notification person that's out of town. You have to have a local person.
Agreed. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Very good. So then that brings us to our FRO procedures. So teasing Bruce on spell check. So, but before we get to there, I would like to add kind of a component here in... We've, in our own code compliance, our code enforcement issues, we've had a number of non-permitted structures or non-permitted add-ons to our single-family residences and probably multifamily residences as well. I'm feeling a desire to have a conversation about requiring as part of the permit that either a code review or a review by staff, if appropriate, to ensure that the building is code compliant with regards to fire suppression systems, whether it's a system or extinguishers or something of whatever that needs to be. And then also if there's unpermitted structures, that either those need to be brought into compliance or permittable so that we're not encouraging the continual proliferation of that.
So you're saying before you would even get your license, you need part of getting your license would be opening your home for a code inspection.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes.
That's a good idea, I think. I mean, we want people to be safe if we're going to allow them to rent. And one thing that's not on the roadmap but is in the staff report is whether to have maximum occupancy. And I would definitely be in favor of that. The staff report says some cities allow two people per bedroom plus two people in the living room. I mean, I would even be fine with just saying you have three bedrooms, six people. I mean, that seems reasonable, but I I do want some sort of maximum occupancy.
So let's have that discussion. So you're saying two people per bedroom. If there's three bedrooms, it's six. If there's two bedrooms, it's four. So
yeah.
Just from personal experience, a lot of times, I've done a lot of Airbnbs personally. I've traveled, and that tends to be the most cost-effective way for my family to travel. And when you have, let's say, a two-bedroom that you're renting with another couple, and one of you has a young child, you're going to be sharing a room with that young child. So, and just using my personal experience, is that then that would preclude me from renting a two-bedroom if I had five people. So just something to consider. I think that is why there's an additional two people allowed for a common area or, a potential infant or...
I mean, maybe it could even...
based on age? I don't...
Yeah. No, I think that's good. That's a really good point. And I think maybe we could even add something like two people under the age of 18 because that would allow for children. I'm just thinking, let's say in the scenario... two people came per bedroom and you had a baby. Probably that baby's not going to make it such an issue that your neighbors are complaining. But it's when you get to, let's say, two people per bedroom and two other partiers in the living room, and that's when the situation starts blowing up. But I think you do make a really good point. So
it's hard to draw that line from family to, vacationers with their friends in their 20s.
So perhaps the direction to staff is to take a look at other ordinances and see if there is a opportunity to put that cap on age, or if it is more malleable of three bedrooms or number of bedrooms times two plus two.
What I can tell you is maybe to my surprise, and looking at the ordinances, most are, as Councilmember Lance indicates, they're two per bedroom with the extra two for that living room or that fold-out couch. You know, getting into age restrictions, I think that may be the intent of some codes, but I, again, get back to the enforcement, and that may be very, very difficult. Yeah. So
okay.
I'm hearing one or the other. It's just two per bedroom or it's two per bedroom plus the two. So, again... the direction we're looking for tonight from council is so we can draft this. We haven't waited on that, but taking it to the Planning Commission, there's more time for public comment, and ultimately you have the ability in that final draft ordinance from you to make final changes and tweaks at that time.
And once we have a draft ordinance in place, it allows a little bit more clarity as to what the points of discussion are for the public and what they want to address specifically. Right now is obviously more of a general discussion of the, the experiences of the community. As we get closer to what the ordinance looks like, then it provides a better framework for people to pinpoint what their issues are with the different sections of ordinance.
Yeah. Well stated. So are we, shall we start with the number of bedrooms times two plus two?
Yeah, I think it's a good place to start because I would like to hear what owners say about that versus neighbors. Because I'm torn as a resident just thinking, because most of the ones in my neighborhood would probably have eight, and how do I feel? So I want to hear from people on that. So,
okay. So it was-
I had an experience with a family visiting from Michigan, and they had five children, and we had a three-bedroom house. So you've got people sleeping everywhere, and I don't think that's the idea behind this sort of thing. So the two per bedroom plus, where are you going to stop with the plus?
Mm-hmm. No, it was literally the number of bedrooms times two, whatever that number is, plus two.
So for the common living area.
Yeah, so it's not three bedrooms. Each bedroom gets two plus two. So it's basically number of bedrooms times two with an aggregate plus two. So it'd be a maximum eight, which is the third bullet.
I understand that.
I hear what Barbara's saying is, and this is where I'm leaning, but let's just leave it to the public. But you're already making a bunch of money off of this. And, okay, maybe then if a family can only have six and they have eight, they'll have to rent a bigger place or, whatever. But then the neighbors who live there are experiencing less traffic. So we'll just see. But I think you're exactly right in what you're saying, that let's just get something down. Then we can pick away at it.
Yeah. Okay.
So which then brings us to violations and fines, I think, procedures for complaints, violations, and fines. Is there, I heard kind of a consensus towards a strict policy. Mm-hmm. So
yes.
Let's have some discussion on how strict we would like to start for staff direction.
I think some hefty fines in place. At first, $750 for a first offense sounded terrifying. However, when you're making $500 to $600 a night, and truthfully, owners may even pass that on to the person, at least part of it, if they incur the fine, I think it will motivate owners to have to educate every single person that comes through the door, which is going to be a pain. So I would be okay with doing the same fine system Pismo has.
Comments to my right?
I am, as far as fine amount, I think definitely has to be more than $100. I just don't think that's enough of a deterrent. I don't know if $750, $1,000, and $1,000 is necessary. Maybe, I mean, I'm just, this is obviously a game of just random numbers, really. I'd say $500. $400 or $500, and then $750 maybe after that. But definitely the three strikes and revocation, right. I would be a proponent of.
Okay, so we'll start with that one. I'm seeing shaking heads and nodding heads. Yeah. So three strikes and they're out.
Yep.
So and yep. So then violations. I'm hearing $500, $250. So. Shall we?
Maybe $500, $750, then $1,000.
Or is it $2,500, $750?
Oh, I think two's not going to do anything.
Okay, just
yeah, start at five.
Figuring out where our floor is.
Okay, if five seems okay for the floor, and it's 75.
Okay. So
$500, $750, $1,000.
That is a good place that I'm hearing consensus.
It's a start.
And then it'll be open for public comment regarding what people think about that.
Okay. So with all of that said, we finished the roadmap on this page. Is there another page to the roadmap?
Only in my head.
If that's the case, then let's make sure that we've got a consensus understanding from staff as to how to craft this component of our roadmap.
Well, in the staff report, there's a little bit more roadmap, and I didn't know if we wanted to go through, because there were just some suggestions. Require the payment of TOT, I think, definitely.
Definitely.
Oh, establish a process, yes. Require that noise ordinance be complied with at all times, definitely. That refuse be stored appropriately and placed out weekly, definitely. Compliance with building codes, as that'll be taken care of, hopefully, up front. No on-site advertising, I think that's very good. And that it has to be legally. So all those additional ones I agree with too.
Yep. I think those were going to be the last.
Okay.
Yes. Those are and two other items, yes.
Yes.
Or peace.
So just to clarify then, as far as compliance with smoke detectors or other fire suppression, that would require an on-site inspection, so I'm hearing that we would do some kind of minimum on-site inspection to at least confirm that that's in place, that the bedrooms meet minimum code requirements for size, which is in the building code, and egress. We would look at garage or on-site parking to verify that. So not a very lengthy inspection, but we would include that in the ordinance. The last thing, accessory dwelling units. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that if you have a legal ADU, that you would only be required to rent either the primary residence or the accessory dwelling unit, not both.
Yes.
Isn't there, what is it now that it has to be low income, or what is it?
That's consistent with our current code, is that one of the units must be owner occupied.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So we would do the same in the draft ordinance. So
I'm and seeing, oops, I just had a question regarding the code visit. Just for the public and my own knowledge, something like that, what would you, how much time do you think that would take to come in, walk around, walk out?
15 minutes.
Is that going to force there to be a high fee to get the permit, or how will we be able to cover our city costs?
Yes, we would cover our city costs. That's obviously not a huge cost for 15 minutes of staff time, quote, processing the permit. And then the other thing that we would try to formulate for you, maybe either as part of the initial action or directly following after that, would be what would be the annual inspection fee. We will talk to some third-party consultants because really this monitoring becomes key, and that is something that having a third party do would be much more efficient, allowing then staff to really work on compliance if there are problems. So we would put together those costs. Again, the fee would have to be reasonably related to those costs that we'd be passing through. But, you know, as an example, if it was $10,000 a year for host compliance and you had 100 people operating, that's $100 per year to do all that monitoring. So I think we can come up with a reasonable annual fee as well.
Okay. Question, Bruce. Would that initial on-site visit also include identifying any additions to the building that have not been permitted or...
Yeah, we would probably really do that through just the records check to verify that this is a three-bedroom home.
Yeah.
Or if you're trying to rent out an accessory structure that wasn't legally permitted, we would catch those things even before we went out.
All right.
Okay. And that was the intent or the hope of that comment, so to be able to capture some of those elements. So I think we've gotten good consensus on preliminary direction to staff. So one other item perhaps on this is public participation. So with regards to, we've heard some feedback this evening, both from supporters and from detractors. What's the sense, and I'll start with, I think our public process is where this needs to happen. I'm seeing that obviously we had a large number of people come out this evening. I don't think a separate public hearing solely for this item or a public forum is going to bring out any different realms of the community to participate in this. So I think I'm kind of leaning towards just the Planning Commission and then the ordinances process here. So unless there's discussion.
I would agree with that because it would go before the Planning Commission and then, as with any ordinance, it would come before us at least twice.
Right. Right.
So that's at least three more public hearings, if not more, probably four at least, to get the original draft. So I think that's a lot of time for people to comment.
They always have the option of you know, writing in or coming to a meeting and asking questions during public comment as well.
Yeah, having the two opportunities, I think the biggest thing is going to be people are going to have, you know, an opinion once they see what the ordinance is and applying that to their specific situations. That's when the commenting is going to be the most important, I think, for the community. So having ample amount of time to council meetings at least to discuss the individual sections of the ordinance, if I'm correct, would be the case.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Then, yeah, I think
so. So from that perspective, I'm hearing a bring back a draft ordinance to the council, which will give an opportunity for additional discussion. And then based upon either the strength of that ordinance, if we then push it to the Planning Commission for their consideration, and then it comes back to the council for two additional first reading and then adoption consideration.
That's correct, and I think the model is somewhat similar to the cannabis ordinances, where we had a discussion like this to frame the issue. We brought back a draft of how we would develop the ordinance, make sure we were hearing the council correctly and we were on the right path, and then the ordinance was developed to the Planning Commission and back to the council for adoption. And as part of that process, we will spell out the implementation in further detail than we have tonight. So that way, council has a sense of how we would actually carry this out from a staffing, resource, funding standpoint, and that can be built into the conversation.
Very good. Okay. Any other comments or discussion that anyone wants to add to this item?
I'm here.
No, I just thank everyone for their hard work on this, and I thank the public for their input, and it's going to remain important.
Yes.
I congratulate all of you on sitting here through this process.
Thank you for participating in this process. And before we leave this item, I'm going to turn it over to the city attorney just to make sure that we haven't shared or done anything this evening that causes you any consternation.
Now, you didn't see me squirming, did you?
I did not, so that's why I was concerned.
No, not yet.
Okay, very good. So then I think that that completes this item. And so let's see. Thank you, everyone, for your input. And there is a process that will be followed as part of this. If you do want to continue being part of this process, please provide your name and contact information to either the city manager or the city clerk, and that'll get you on the list for public notification as we go through this process as well, very similar to what we've done in other situations in the past. So with that, that completes our formal items for this evening. Now we get into council committee reports, and I'll go. Let's see. We'll start with Councilmember Peterson. Any reports on your end?
The only one I've attended, I've got one tomorrow, was Zone 3, and there are three things that were, I think, would be of concern to the public generally. They talked about reservoir levels, and we're still only at about 40%. But even with all the rains, and this was as of last week, we'd only come up about 1%. And 1% is a lot. It's a lot because it's a big reservoir. But it's not nearly as high as the other reservoirs. And so my question to them is, well, what's changed? So I think that's something that needs more investigation, and I'll follow up on that. They also talked a lot about, what are the criteria for the enactment of our low reservoir response plan? And it's quite a complicated thing, and it will be going to the Board of Supervisors. They've been kind of, well, in my opinion, dragging their feet just because they want to kind of wait and see what happens with the rains, which is I think, par for the course. And so we can follow that and see where that goes. And then finally, there have been a number of assessments of the spillway and or they're in process or almost completed. And I just think for the public generally, I felt very confident that it's being everything's being well inspected by engineers and we're safe. I hate to say that, but I was pleased to see how many assessments there are and that we're getting good reports on all of them. Some minor things to do, but they're little housekeeping things. Okay. So that was it for Zone 3.
Great. And just a quick follow-up on that. I did just look at the reservoir storage, and we just broke the 20,000 acre-feet limit. So as of like 3 minutes ago.
It went up a little bit.
It went up just a little bit. Good. So there is runoff coming into the lake, but it would be great to have more.
Well, I think they said 500 acre-feet is 1%, and 500 acre-feet is half to a third of what we use in the whole city of Gober Beach for a year. So it's significant. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of water. Yeah. But we still need a lot more.
We do need more, yes.
Okay. We're not out of the woods.
Yep. Mayor Pro Tem Shaw.
I had a Homeless Services Oversight Council meeting last week. The main items that we discussed are that pertain to Gober Beach will be the HEAP grant fund request should be coming hopefully within 2 weeks. The state takes our good time in getting us a request, and then we're going to have about 3 weeks to turn that around and get our requests in. But to that end, Matt and I, City Manager Brunson and I, will be meeting with members from the South County on Thursday to keep solidifying a proposal, which we do plan to have before the council, for public discussion during the submittal process, before the submittal process. So that will be out in the public. We're kind of just waiting on the state to see exactly what we're being asked for and what we're being asked to do. But the long-term plan is then the plans will all be presented to the Board of Supervisors by the end of April, probably the April 23rd meeting, and that's when we'll find out which ones the Board of Supervisors want to submit then back to the state and which ones they want to fund. So that's the timeline on that. The homeless point in time count is coming up next week. It is, the morning of January 28th. And from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m., anyone homeless sleeping outside will be counted. And this is how we get our numbers for grant funding and federal funding. So they're always looking for more volunteers. If people are interested, they can shoot me an email and I will get them in contact with the right people. And there's a training that goes with that that can also be done online. And we had our HSOC leadership elections. Nobody wanted to nominate themselves for any position, so everyone kept their position. So I stayed vice chair of the Homeless Services Oversight Council, and Kristen Barnich of Arroyo Grande is the chair. And HomeShare Slow is changing their name. They're going to have a new name in the new year, but I forgot to write down the new name. But it's because not only will they be encouraging home sharing, they're also going to encourage yard sharing, because City of San Luis Obispo is now allowing tiny homes on wheels. Mm-hmm. So they're going to encourage people, if you will provide yard space for a tiny home, that'll be a new kind of share. So they're going to kind of broaden their name. Oh, also, I think because someone in the Bay Area was using HomeShare and they did not want to share the name HomeShare. Right. So more to come on that. And then I got to go to the League of Cities Communities.
We'll hold on that one for just a second. So, but before we leave the HSOC, or the Homeless Services Oversight Council, and the point in time, so I just wanted to announce as well that the Five Cities Homeless Coalition Warming Shelter is going to be open Sunday night.
Oh, okay.
So regardless of whether it meets the criteria for rain or for cold, the temperature, as an opportunity to, for those people that do come to the shelter, they will immediately be counted as part of the closure of the shelter that Sunday morning. So in conjunction with that activity, so the shelter will be open on Sunday night. So
could I ask a question on that again? You were talking about the HEAP process and it was coming back to South County for public input. I'm getting a lot of questions from the public. When? Do you know when that, do you have any, is that February?
Yes, and City Manager Bronson has kind of a good timeline on that. It's really just when we can fit it, when we can get the formal proposal, and then when we can fit it in one of our council meetings.
Okay. That's correct. We're waiting twofold, one on the county/state process for when the HEAP grant applications would be requested and then due, so we can time the presentation with that. And two, this involves a property transaction potentially. So we're trying to work with the parties so that they can complete their business so that we can bring this forward with a little more certainty than just a proposal. So aiming for the end of February, but we'll have to see again how those two different dates unfold.
Thank you.
Anything and else? Just, I attended last week the Community Services Policy Committee meeting for the League of Cities in Sacramento. And so this year I'll be on that policy committee. And we just kind of decided what our priorities would be. Of course, homelessness is the number one priority and thing that we want to work on. And that, and also looking at programs for different stages of life, like children and seniors. We got a rundown on Governor Newsom's budget, and just some of the most interesting parts is just he wants to allocate a lot more money to expand childcare infrastructure, also expand kindergarten and community colleges. So it's, you know, when you see where the money's going, we tend to want to help in that area direct. So more to come as we form a plan for the year. But just with League of Cities business, we just got word our next League of Cities dinner will be March 8th in Carpinteria for the Channel Counties Division.
Very good. Thank you for those reports. So, Councilmember Nichols, any reports?
Yes. Five Cities Fire Authority will have a meeting here at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. And I'll be able to report on that in 2 weeks. The South County Chambers, the government committee was informed that by the Chambers board that one of the first things they're going to do during this year is write a public policy manual, decide on a public policy manual to follow, which I think will be very interesting and get our business community a little bit more organized and interested in public policy themselves, support of public policy. That's it.
Okay. Any committees?
Not yet, reports? But I look forward to the next time that I eventually have something to report.
Okay. Very good. Thanks. And then I'll just do a quick report. We did have an Integrated Waste Management Authority meeting, and it was effectively a meeting to decide to hold interviews for the general manager position, and those will be coming up on February 1st, so with three selected finalists. So more to follow on that. And then I did sit in on the SLOCOG, SLORTA, Council Government / Regional Transit Authority meeting as well, and that, I'm not on the executive committee for that, but Fred Strong is the new president of that. I did become the alternate on LOSAN, which Los Angeles, San Diego train service. I know there's a more acronyms there that I'll need to learn. And then there was significant discussion once again on the El Campo intersection and the potential procedure for Caltrans to consider closing that at-grade service, as well as three other ones in that area. But there is a process that they need to go through, and which does include concurrence with the county as well as City of Arroyo Grande. So more to come on that as that comes forward. And then League of California Cities, just a real brief update on that. I did attend the Transportation Communication and Public Works Policy Committee, short TCPW. As they kept saying in the committee, SB1 success last year kind of set the groundwork for this year, that there's going to be very little transportation issues surrounding the League of California Cities this year, which was the statement until the governor's budget came out, in the fact that he is attempting to connect SB1 funds to our housing numbers that are requirement. That was part of the discussion. That was a very strong rollout, and then as in the committee, we kind of pushed back on the Secretary of Transportation, and the comment was, don't expect any changes this year. However, if you do start to just flat out deny all housing projects for no apparent good finding reasons, that is when the stick will become SB1. So they are willing to go in that direction because of the governor's desire to increase the housing numbers. It remains to be seen what kind of leveraged the housing numbers and SB1 funds will actually enact. So more to follow on that one as well. Other fascinating discussions on drones and small cells are in the future of that policy committee. With that, I'll turn it to council communications, see if we have, and then I'll let the city manager speak on his policy committee when we get to his report. But any council communications to my left, to my right?
The chamber dinner coming up.
Yes.
On the 30th or 31st?
On the 30th.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yep. On the 30th. So that will be before we meet again. But yes, that is on the 30th. So we'll look forward to seeing as many of us there as possible.
Yeah.
Okay. So any other council communications? If none, we'll turn it to the city manager for his report.
Thank you, council. Just three items for you this evening. Keeping with the policy committee theme, I'm a member on the Governance, Transparency, and Labor Relations Committee, otherwise known as GTLR. And our committee really is about the internal workings of government, if you think about it that way. There are three main priorities for the committee this coming year. Pension reform will be the biggest one. There are three court cases before the California Supreme Court that will govern how pensions are funded and the benefits regarding pensions. And those cases could have a significant impact on the pension landscape across California in local government, state government. So more to come on that, and we'll see how the court rules. Also, we'll be looking at elections, and in particular district elections, and how that is unfolding across the state and some other election alternatives that are out there. And lastly, how the Brown Act intersects with social media is a topic that has come up at the committee level, so we'll be looking at that further. I want to advise the council that February will be an active month with goal setting. So on February 4th at the next council meeting, we'll be introducing our 10-year financial forecast. That will really be a kickstart for our budget process as well as our goal-setting process for the coming year. We also will have Ken Hampion, who will be leading the council through a goal-setting process at the end of the month, help to kick off the process and give you an assignment of identifying up to 7 individual priorities as a prelude for the collective discussion coming up at the end of February. We're also building in a community forum in this year's process to test out having a separate event that will seek input from community members on priorities and potential goals to help inform the council's deliberations at the end of February. This community forum is scheduled for Monday, February 11th from 6:30 to 8:30 at Ramona Center. This will be a facilitated session where we'll have small group discussions where all voices will be heard and welcomed. We also will have an online component for those who aren't able to make that meeting. So February 11th, 6:30 to 8:30, and we'll have information going out later this week on social media, on our website, and also at the front counter with flyers. And then we have the February 22nd workshop for the council, 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock on Friday the 22nd. And lastly, with our public works director here in the audience, I'll highlight that we are working on the second phase of the Oak Park Boulevard medians, south of Farrell all the way to the Pike. So we're doing some more work to help improve the look and feel of the medians on this major gateway to the city. And then lastly, the South 16th Street and Farrell Road stop signs, all-way traffic control and crosswalks are coming very soon. We believe by the end of this week, we're finalizing the schedule with our contractor. We have some signs in place now, but the actual installation of the stop signs and the crosswalks will be in place end of this week and be able to introduce four-way traffic control and safer crossing at this important intersection. Again, that's with the council approval earlier this year. And that concludes my report.
Thank you for those updates. City Attorney, do you have any reports this evening?
The only thing I wanted to mention to you is that for the most part since I've been here, you haven't really had a protocol resolution or policy. So what I'm going to do is put something together for you in the near future, bring it for you for discussion, and then if you're comfortable with that, we'll bring it back in the form of a resolution for you to approve. Other than that, that's it.
Okay. Thank you very much. So with that, we will stand adjourned.
I drive Farrell all the time.